I then wrote back and said, look, the ripples from this will be enormous. What do you want to do?
The new series of The Gift with me, Jenny Kleeman, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Starts this Wednesday morning at 9:30.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Sunday the 3rd of November. This is Charles Carroll. Good morning. The new Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, is beginning the process of choosing her shadow cabinet. She aims to have a team in place by Tuesday. Mrs. Badenoch has promised to renew the Tory party and to prepare for government, but she said that new policies and a plan for implementing them will take a few years to develop. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
Kemi Badenoch has said that her first responsibility is to hold Labour to account. For that, she'll need a new front bench in place. But some familiar faces and experienced ministers have ruled themselves out. The leadership contender and current Shadow Home Secretary, James Cleverley, has indicated that he's returning to the back benches. Joining him will be the Shadow Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, and fellow Shadow Cabinet members, Steve Barclay and Sir Oliver Dowden. During the leadership campaign, Mrs. Badenoch suggested her defeated rivals would be offered a place at the top table. But sources close to the new opposition leader told the BBC late last night that no job offers had yet been made. Her ambition is to remake what she regards as a broken system of government, and she wants, in her words, to see a state which does fewer things better.
Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have been campaigning in the southeastern United States, targeting the close contests which could decide who wins the White House. They both held rallies in North Carolina, one of the seven swing states which could yet back either candidate. Ms. Harris promised tax cuts, while Mr. Trump said he would deport millions of immigrants. The head of the Valencia region in Spain says electricity has been restored to almost all the areas hit by deadly flash floods. But many people are still without drinkable water. More than 200 people were killed and dozens more are still missing. Our Southern Europe correspondent Mark Lowen reports from Valencia.
Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez has acknowledged the anger here from those furious that the flood warning came too late and the authorities' response has come too slow. Some of the 10,000 soldiers and police officers he's pledged will arrive today in Spain's biggest ever peacetime deployment of the military. They will encounter a devastated region. Entire neighbourhoods on the outskirts of Valencia remain caked in mud, the streets strewn with mangled cars, uprooted trees and the detritus of destroyed homes. Dozens are still missing as rescuers comb through underground car parks and tunnels in the hope less of finding survivors than retrieving the dead.
Israel has denied being behind a strike on a vaccination clinic in northern Gaza, which injured six people. The incident occurred as health workers relaunched an emergency polio vaccination drive for children in Gaza City. The campaign had been delayed due to the Israeli operation against Hamas in the area. And the US military says several B-52 strategic bombers have arrived in the Middle East. The Pentagon announced their deployment yesterday as a warning to Iran. Detectives investigating allegations of historical sex offences made against Russell Brand have sent prosecutors a file of evidence so they can consider whether to charge him. The comedian and actor has been interviewed three times by police about the claims, which he's previously denied. Francis Reed has this report.
The allegations against Russell Brand emerged during an investigation last year by the Sunday Times, The Times and Channel 4's dispatches. They cover a seven-year period when he was at the height of his fame, starring in Hollywood films and holding several high-profile jobs, including at Channel 4 and at BBC Radio 2. The Metropolitan Police said it had received a number of reports of sexual offences from women following the original investigation and had interviewed Russell Brand three times. Detectives have now sent the Crown Prosecution Service a file of evidence so it can consider whether or not to bring charges. The CPS says any decision is made independently based on the evidence. Russell Brand has previously denied the allegations, calling them very, very hurtful.
Humberside police say a teenage boy has been charged with the attempted murder of a girl who was found with stab wounds near Hull on Friday morning. The 14-year-old boy, who can't be named because of his age, is due before magistrates on Monday. The girl, who's 13, is in a serious but stable condition in hospital. Cricket. England's men have levelled their one-day series against the West Indies with a 5-wicket victory in Antigua. Set a target of 329, they reached it with 15 deliveries to spare. Daniel Norcross was watching.
Quite magnificent innings by Liam Livingstone, their standing captain. 124 not out. They were in all sorts of bother early on, but he's hit 5 fours and 9 massive sixes to hunt down a chase that no one really thought they would manage. It means that the series is now 1-1. They go to Barbados for the next game on Wednesday with everything to play for.
Daniel Norcross, BBC News.
On BBC iPlayer.
Asia is home to the most extraordinary life. The largest owls. The world's smallest elephants. The richest seas on the planet. The biggest of all big cats. The world's rarest bear.
Asia with David Attenborough.
If you think you've seen the best the natural world has to offer, think again.
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
A combination of subsidy systems and shifts in population have affected black farmers in the deep south of the United States. In turn, they've led to a disconnect between food and farming there. We'll head to the heart of Louisiana later this hour on Radio 4 to hear about a small farm there using a thin strip of land on the banks of the Mississippi to grow vegetables to provide fresh food for neighbours and local food banks. The farmers hope that could encourage young people nearby to grow their own food and eventually consider full-time careers in agriculture. On Your Farm is in half an hour. But now on Radio 4, here's Laurie Taylor with Thinking Aloud.
Hello. You know, I've always rather wished that I had a better collection of childhood memories. But when I try to recall those early years, it's not the taste and flavour of the Proustian Madeleine biscuit which jerks them into consciousness, but the distinctive shape of a jar of Marmite, the technicolour portrait of a British and Indian soldier on the side of a bottle of camp coffee, the legend on the side of the black and white packet of senior service which boasted that the cigarettes were, and I quote, a product of the mastermind. Well, it was only as I began to read and relish a new book entitled The Not-So-Secret Lives of Food Packaging that I began to feel more comfortable with my addiction, at least my childhood addiction, to what contained my food and drink preferences rather than their intrinsic content. But there remained a mystery. How might something so, well, evidently banal become a major topic of sociological inquiry? And that has to be my first question to the author of that book. She is Anne Murcott, Honorary Professorial Research Associate at SOAS, University of London, and she now joins me. So, Anne, why did it all interest you so much?
One reason is simple. Food packaging is invented, manufactured, used and disposed of by people, involving any number of social institutions and established social relationships. And as the cliche has it, these institutions and social relationships run from farm to fork. This was my starting point for the book. The question about how what I've called the modern food packaging landscape got to be as it is. All those aisles of paper bags of sugar, chiller cabinets full of plastic trays, fish pie, roast lamb, mashed potato, tray sealed with more plastic, the lot wrapped around with a cardboard sleeve with a photograph of the contents and the instructions for cooking printed on it. What is their history? And this leads to a related reason for being interested in food packaging. Sociologists commonly overlook the things that are caught up in social relationships. Think about the image of an old-fashioned grocer. You know, you can remember it. A man with a sort of brownish coat, faintly obsequious. He understood his clientele, he knew his stock and he could make recommendations. And as the stock grew larger and the choice grew greater, so they needed his help even more. Fast forward to nowadays, the grocer's pretty much disappeared, and with it, that relationship. And it's been replaced by the package which tells you what's in the package, it tells you how to cook the package, it tells you how nutritious it is. And that thing has supplanted the relationship between the grocer and the customer.
Let's just talk a little bit about the ubiquity of all this, because you do say that packaging is everywhere and nowhere. I mean, what do you mean by that exactly?
It's litter. It's on an office desk. We've got paper cups of water to keep us going while we talk. It's in school lunchboxes. But it's sort of nowhere in that, despite being ubiquitous, it is, as Thomas Hine, who was an American historian of design, rather neatly observed, he said, packaging is hidden in plain sight. So it can become part of the familiar surroundings, aisle upon aisle in a supermarket or filling shelves in the kitchen cupboards, but it's invisible in its familiarity.
The entire contemporary food system does seem to be held together by packaging, you want to argue. Expand on that for me. In what ways?
What's commonly known as the global food system would look really very different without food packaging. Food packaging makes it possible to transport green beans grown in Kenya, typically packed in sort of perforated plastic bags. They're made of polyethylene, packed on the spot into those bags, then transported in the bays that are underneath passenger cabins on passenger jets to warehouses and supermarkets, whether they be in Helsinki, Glasgow or Berlin. That packaging also allows cans of pumpkin puree, which are very likely packed in what's known as secondary packaging of cardboard boxes. So you've got a cardboard box of cans of pumpkin puree, which in turn are transported in another level of packaging, which would be in shipping containers from manufacturers in the US to supermarkets in Europe for Americans far from home to make pumpkin pie for Thanksgiving. And without the packaging, the foodstuffs couldn't move like that.
You look at major items of food packaging, you look at the materials from which they've been made, you talk about bags and sacks and barrels and chests and bottles and jars and canisters and cans. Take, for example, a bag of watercress salad, how it gets to the supermarket shelf and how it relates to packaging. So tell me about that journey of that simple product.
The watercress journey tells a story of the way that in some instances a preservation technique can't exist without the associated package. I'll come back to that in a second, but if we go back a century or more, bunches of watercress were transported by train to late 19th century London from where they grew in Hampshire. But once they got to London, those unwrapped bunches would eventually be sold to passers-by in the street by young girls, impoverished and often barefoot. But nowadays, raw salads are packed in transparent bags made of polythene, which is a petroleum-based resin. And this extends their shelf life way beyond that of the bunches of watercress which those young girls used to wash at the pump and try and plump them up to make them look fresh and appealing. Their shelf life is extended by industrialised processes that modify the atmosphere around the leaves in the bag. Same gases as in the air we breathe.
Let's turn to another supermarket item. Tell me a little about the very familiar object, a plastic bottle of milk.
Imagine a building on an industrial estate. This one is different from most because in the single building there are two factories. Each is owned by a separate company, although they are symbiotically related. The one needs the other. One factory in the building is a dairy dedicated to milk processing and filling those plastic bottles that you mentioned. On the other side of the internal wall dividing them is a different company which manufactures the bottles, which the dairy then fills. So coming into the dairy is milk coming in tankers from nearby farms, conveyed in bulk tankers, and there's some 120 tankers come in every day. Coming into the other factory that makes the bottles are consignments of pellets. They're pellets of high-density polyethylene. You've probably seen on the back of something which says it's recycled HDPE, high-density polyethylene. And dispatched from the dairy are those familiar supermarket cages loaded with about 80, perhaps 100, 120 plastic bottles of milk each. And the dairy is designed to produce 1,000 million litres of fresh bottled milk annually. The whole symbiotic process runs continuously, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. The bottle manufacturing factory supplies all the dairy's needs, and the bottles are made by an extrusion blow moulded process. Very simple. It echoes the manner in which a glass bottle is blown, good several centuries old. And that completed bottle joins a line of other bottles on a line that snakes round the factory. And if you follow it, you realise it disappears through the wall. And it goes through to the other factory, where the ownership of the bottles transfers from the manufacturer to the dairy.
You highlight associated history, such as the processing of tomato ketchup and how it impacted upon the development of packaging. Unpack that history for me.
Henry Heinz was a real trailblazer. If you think about it, food packaging involves a conundrum because it encloses the contents to keep it safe, to keep it clean, to stop anybody tampering, etc. But that means that if you and I or I want to buy something as packaging, the package gets in the way between us and finding out what the quality of the foodstuff is. You know, you can't pick it up and sniff it, or even, dare I say, taste an apple that you're going to buy. It's packed. And as the French sociologist Franck Cauchois, he, among others, points out ways of covering and simultaneously displaying the food inside the package that nonetheless presents a potential difficulty for the customer who can't get at it and the producer who can't display it properly. So let's work backwards towards the time of Henry Heinz, last quarter of the 19th century, and take the first example of the advantage provided by cellophane. And it's argued that the introduction of cellophane as a very early transparent packaging for perishable foodstuffs represented a new way for shoppers to understand food quality. And this new visuality becomes prominent. So, for instance, there's a 1945 advertisement for bread wrapped in DuPont cellophane declaring that cellophane, at a great emphasis, shows what it protects, more emphasis. But go back further, over half a century before cellophane, to Henry Heinz, where we started. He started out as a boy helping his mother to harvest and to turn homegrown horseradish, a very fiery kind of root, into a preserved relish. So Henry Heinz took to bottling horseradish for sale. And unlike the small local trade in pre-prepared horseradish sauce, which pre-existed his bottling his mother's horseradish, which used brown or green glass bottles, he bottled his in clear glass. And part of his sales pitch stressed that the transparent bottles allowed customers to see for themselves before purchasing that there were no unwanted fillers, nobody was padding it out with turnip, which was cheaper, and that the roots were well grated, there were no lumps. And his use of clear bottles was material expression of his business commitment, his business ethos, to honesty and to hygienic dealings with his customers. And Heinz, the company, still packs tomato ketchup to optimise its visibility.
Well, I've got a reading here. This is from Metal Box, a history by W.J. Reader, published in 1976, and expresses, well, some of the earlier anxieties about food packaging.
The packaging industry can be represented as an undesirable and unrighteous manifestation of the consumer society. Adding unnecessary frills and expense to the process of distribution, using scarce materials extravagantly, disfiguring the landscape with litter and contributing, especially in the food industries, to the debasement of taste with products cultivated and processed by unnatural means.
There is a growing concern, isn't there, about food packaging and the way it might be contributing to environmental pollution. The idea of reducing plastic, I mean, that's very current, isn't it? Let's try and reduce the plastic whenever we can. But you want to say, really, the arguments aren't always as straightforward as they seem. It's not all black and white.
It seems pretty obviously worthwhile a thing to do to support a campaign to reduce the use of single-use plastic, especially when, you know, you or I might week after week be unwrapping apples or bananas or oranges and stuffing the packaging in the bin, when, you know, apples can be washed and bananas and oranges have their own packaging. So why are they being packaged? Does it not smack of over-packaging? Food packaging insiders, experts in the field, point out that by the time the apple or the banana gets to your or my kitchen, the packaging's done its job. It's kept the fruit clean since it left the orchard. It's limited the risk of anybody tempted to tamper with the package. And it's also reduced the risk of bruising and damaging. And that important job tends to be invisible to the supermarket shopper who finds their kitchen bin regularly filling up with used packaging. Introducing alternatives that do the same useful job on the journey from field to fridge, but that do not introduce new problems, is not always straightforward. Campaigns that blindly call for all plastics to be removed without being sure that replacements would not make matters worse are potentially tricky. For instance, a current example is the removal of plastic lids from supermarket pots of hummus or coleslaw, and they're replaced by a sort of peel-off plastic film which is glued to the rim of the pot. But without the top that clicks back onto the pot, storing a half-filled potful can become that much more difficult. And there's a risk that that might increase food waste. And the lid couldn't close properly. And so that might increase food waste, which undermines one of the virtues that the packaging industry insiders claim for food packaging, the virtue of keeping food fresh and reducing food waste.
And there we must stop. Anne Murcott, thank you very much for the moment. Now, a few weeks ago, I realised it was a long time since we'd invited our old friends Mike and Alison round to dinner. Well, simple enough situation to remedy, a quick, friendly email was all that was required. But that was when the problems began. What to serve? Wasn't it Mike who had once railed against the impurities of all kinds of snacks? And when it came to the main dish, wasn't it Alison who'd gone on and on and on one evening about how much of the food we ate had been the subject of invidious processing? Well, some, if not all, of these concerns of mine might have been alleviated or diminished if at the time I'd read a new book with the controversial title In Defence of Processed Food. And its author, who now joins me, is Anastasia Marks de Salcedo, a public health consultant and public policy researcher. Fair to say, really, isn't it, Anastasia, that at the moment there's a considerable critique of processed foods. I mean, I'm constantly reading articles protesting about over-processing, yet your book constitutes a defence of them. You interestingly argue there's a gap between the image that we all have of processed food and the reality. And also, there's a great deal of confusion about definitions. Could you expand on that for me?
The interesting thing is that this is not only for the general public, but for food researchers and policy researchers as well. Milk and yogurt, which appear to be whole foods, are actually highly manipulated in the industrial food system. I was looking at both things that were very lightly processed to very heavily processed and things that were highly convenient. That means, you know, you can simply open the package and pop it in your mouth to not convenient, something you would, might have to cook from scratch. And by consolidating those two schemes, I could identify one category of food that I think we can all agree that we might not want to eat too much of, which are often called highly processed or ultra processed food. Things like desserts, snack foods, sodas, and condiments. As far as the rest of the foods, they are mostly fairly healthful. They can be easily incorporated as part of your daily fare and should be because they allow a tremendous time saving. One of the issues has been this imprecision in terms of the definition.
There has been a huge growth, hasn't there, in the food additives, quoting here, I think, from you, something like an estimated 25,000 chemical compounds were tested between 1940 and 1960. And they're very much a cause for concern, aren't they?
Industrial food really took off after World War II. And to prepare military rations that were safe and able to be shipped all over the globe, in the decades that followed, there were a number of different additives that were approved, antimicrobials, colorants, things that would, you know, change the textures of the food.
You talk about the way in which convenience foods, these are the ones which are often referred to as processed foods, isn't it? At first, they got a very warm welcome, but it changed. Why did it change?
At first, convenience foods and or processed foods were heralded as a tremendous boon to the housewife, and they were seen as a way that people could devote more time to leisure activities and then simply be able to open a package and heat something up. Over time, two different trends put that pressure on that vision. And the first one was the environmental movement. And if we think back in the United States to Ralph Nader and his book, The Chemical Feast, people began to be concerned about, again, anything, the addition of artificial ingredients, the use of, as the first guest is talking about, of packaging. And so people began to get suspicious and concerned about food. The second trend was the gourmet trend of the 1980s or so, where people suddenly discovered making elaborate meals from scratch. And that kind of culminated with the vision of Michael Pollan, to which the title of my book refers, whose book, In Defense of Food, advocates only eating things that our grandparents would be able to recognize as food. Two trends, the environmental and the foodie trend, have really put processed food in a very poor light.
It was very interesting the way in which you talked about how much time women dedicate to family food preparation and the relationship between this and your arguments about processed food. Expand on that connection for me.
With all the advances in terms of the Industrial Revolution and the Sexual Revolution and even the Agricultural Revolution, women are still doing most of the cooking in families. And in support of that argument, I relied on a document, which was a study done by an economist, Jacques Charmes, at the United Nations, on time use around the world. He looked at 65 different countries and different regions and analyzed the amount of time men and women were doing in what is called care work versus productive work, which is a work you do for pay. That book did not break down the amount of time women were spending cooking. So I went back, and as a project with some students, reanalyzed that. And we were able to get data for, I think, 57 to 58 of the original countries. And what we found in the global north and in countries that are most in economically advanced and industrial, women were spending the least amount of time cooking. Those were, not coincidentally, the countries in which women's rights were most advanced by international standards. The countries in which women were spending the most amount of time cooking, which was often between 2 to 3 hours a day, places like Algeria, Tunisia, Pakistan, Serbia, Romania, those countries were often the least economically developed and the places where women's rights were least advanced. And we could find no correlation between the countries where women were cooking the most and overall health. And in fact, the two biggest factors in that were wealth and access to medical care. Looking at the countries where women were spending the least amount of time cooking, we find that those are countries which also have a well-developed industrial food system.
I've got a clip here. This is from 2023. It's BBC One's Panorama, which is entitled Ultra-Processed Food, A Recipe for Ill Health. And the documentary It features identical twins, Amy and Nancy, who participated in a short-term experiment to compare the effects of eating ultra-processed foods versus raw or low-processed foods.
Are you interested to find out how you got on?
Yeah, we don't know anything, so we're excited to find out.
Amy, you were on the ultra-processed food diet that was exactly equivalent to the same diet that Nancy was on, which was the whole food unprocessed diet, but your results were really quite different to your sister's. They were far worse. Your blood fat levels actually went up. Your lipids, which are markers of heart disease, they were increased. Your blood sugar was noticeably worse. You actually gained weight, nearly a kilogram, and you actually lost weight.
It's a bit scary, isn't it, after only 2 weeks to see those sorts of results.
So just imagine what that would be over 20 years.
An interest in buying local produce and eating less processed foods, I think that's blossomed in the late 1990s and the first decades, really, of the 21st century. Many people listening to this programme now would see this as a positive development in the light of the kind of harms we've just been hearing about in that BBC clip. Your research suggests there's a downside.
This is the consumption of ultra-processed foods, which I agree should only be eaten in moderation. On the other hand, there are many highly processed foods that we commonly eat as part of our regular diets, and I think they're perfectly fine. And that would include, say, a spaghetti dinner, which pretty much every element of is a highly processed food, from the tomato sauce to the pasta to the grated cheese that you would put on top. But yes, there is a small category that you should be very careful about and only consume as treat. The issue that I see with sort of the vision, the slow food vision and the sustainable agriculture vision has to do with size. Somebody who is trying to run a small local farm, it's something that, first of all, is not going to allow them to thrive economically. My own ancestors were farmers who, in my grandparents' generations, actually were the first to escape generations of hardscrabble lives. People have forgotten that subsistence agriculture consumes most of your time. If it were expanded to be a system, one of the things that is often identified as being a drag on a country's development is having a very large agricultural sector and having a lot of people who rely on it for their livelihood. We have the most affordable, safest, most accessible food system that the planet has ever seen. And sure, there are things that can be improved, but it's really been something that has allowed us tremendous freedom to turn our attention to other things. We don't have to be tending our crops every day and worrying about where our next meal is going to come from.
And you're talking about changes in the way food is being processed, that these changes may eventually eliminate the most important objection to convenience items, namely healthfulness.
We will continue to improve the healthfulness of processed food. There are a tremendous number of plant-based additives that are replacing some of the synthetic chemical ones. It's in our best interest to see that they continue to develop in this direction.
Anne Murcott is still here with me. I wanted to ask her, when you were listening to that argument, was there something in there which caught your attention?
I was reminded of a lovely piece of history by a historian called Alice Weinreb, which centres on divided Germany during the Cold War. East Germany, communism, was caricatured as a population of unfree, even starving people, whereas the West Germany was free but also satiated. And in the East, the prevailing ideology was every adult should be employed and go out to work and contribute. And as a consequence of that, or associated with that, convenience food was widely extolled and promoted. Whereas in the West Germany, at the same time, schools, there was no requirement to stay after lunch. So the kids went home and the woman was at home cooking, possibly from scratch. And that difference between West Germany and East Germany was an important component of the identity of those who lived in the West, distinguishing themselves from those in the East.
Fascinating. Thank you so much. And thank you also, Anastasia Sacedo. I leave it to Mae West, I think, to provide an antidote to, well, our current glut of dietary obsessions. I never, never worry about diets, she stridently declared. Frankly, the only carrots that interest me are the number in a diamond.
Thinking Aloud is presented by Laurie Taylor and produced by Jane Edgerton.
The Law Show on BBC Radio 4, discussing the legal issues behind the headlines and explaining how law impacts all our lives. Each episode, we delve into the most pressing legal questions of our time, from property to education, from family to housing. By listening into our show, you gain a new understanding into the law, which affects all of us. The new series of The Law Show with me, Dr. Joelle Grogan, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Wednesday afternoon at 3.
Now on Radio 4, we travel to the deep south of the United States, where Helen Chersky is on your farm with Leroy Konish.
Farming is, to me, a part of life that creates more life. If you understand what it means to be part of something that's growing and getting better, and then that farming experience is it.
So we can see the bank of the Mississippi just ahead of us. Does that make a difference to the way your farm works?
It does, because the closer you get to the river, the more fertile the land, and that's where you can get your best benefit from farming, get your best produce and your best crops. So, yeah, it makes a big difference. And also having access to the water, because we have a high water table, so we can do wells. And I do have a well as well.
So yes. Do people pump water out of the river to irrigate, or does it just come from underneath, from the wells?
A lot of people just use municipal water, and to me it's not that good because they have a lot of chemicals in it. So plants tend to grow better with natural products and natural water.
So this morning for On Your Farm, I'm here in Louisiana on the farm of Leroy Konish, and it's a beautiful sunny morning. The Mississippi is just behind us over there. There's a big, can't actually see it because there's a big earth bank. But it's sunny and there's birds around us. And Leroy, tell us about your farm.
Well, this is River Road Farm. I will be planting probably squash in this area here and zucchini. I do crookneck yellow squash as well in this area. And we recently have gotten a few contracts to help provide food to food banks so we can help build food systems. And having gone through the pandemic and supply chain issues, it's been known that we have to try to make foods more available, more locally available. And in my community, we really don't have any grocery stores that are providing that service to a community. And we have a issue with obesity and other health-related issues that evolve from not having proper diet. So by providing fresh foods and fresh vegetables, we can make our presence worthy.
Tell me a little bit about the soil here. Is this a difficult place to farm? Do you need to do a lot to the land to get good crops?
Yes, it's a difficult place to farm, but you have to understand the value of what you have. See, with clay, it compacts too much sometimes when it's too wet. It doesn't allow the nutrients to be absorbed properly in the plants, so we have to amend it. I really don't like to till much, but I have to do it to a degree where I can implement putting in pelletized lime, which helps to aerate it, and use root crops a lot because that also aerates it, and use cover crops to make sure that we can have enough nutrients. And if you notice this right here, we're gonna
see what we got.
It's a baby turnip. So this is what we're gonna use as cover crops.
So it's about the size of a ping pong ball. It is a very baby turnip.
Yeah, and these are actually the most delectable. Both tender.
Yeah.
What we're going to do is just incorporate it into the soil, because I'm going to be transitioning to organic certain sections of the farm. Going organic is going to help decrease the amount of carbon that I'm putting out and the amount of fuel that I'm using, actually. So it's going to be a win-win. The only problem is the cost and being cost-effective, and that's what I'm working on right now. But if you notice how sticky this is, because of the moisture in the soil.
Oh, right, yeah. So it's kind of glued to the bottom of the turnip here.
Yeah. You can see the water. We just had a rain last night.
Oh, so we're looking at this big kind of ruts, and the troughs are filled with puddles.
Right. And exactly. You can crumble it, and you can see it sticks together.
Oh, that is very heavy clay, isn't it?
Right, wow. Right. Now, what I do, I use a soil meter most of the time to tell whether or not I have proper pH. Does anyone here know what pH means?
So it's a measure of acidity, how acid or alkaline the soil is.
Exactly. And it's what I would consider the term coming from the power of hydrogen. So right. pH, power, hydrogen.
I've never heard that, but I like that. That's great.
And the thing about it retains water. It doesn't leak water out a lot. So when it's drought periods, real dry, my crops really grow well still.
And how long have you been farming here?
I've been farming here since about 2004, commercially. It was key to me as a child that if you own land, you would have some advantages. And farming was a thing that my parents did growing up, because we grew most of our food. And my grandfather, he had about a 5-acre farm, and I used to hate that. Just get up early. It's cold, just like right now.
Who choose to do that?
We had no choice. If we wanted to eat that day, we had to work that day, you know. But it's a blessing to be able to help other people. And with people like Sprout and other agencies, it helps to make us more sustainable. And that's the whole key, because small farmers pretty much have been wiped out. And then, historically speaking, African-American farmers are far and few in between. But the most important thing about what we're doing here, we can build this, help people, and at the same time, we can also encourage other farmers to be developed as we go through programs, because mentor programs, and I'm negotiating with some people right now in order to help facilitate that, because we have a shortage of farmers.
And we've got Amelia Bird here as well from Sprout. Just tell us a little bit about what Sprout does.
Sprout is a nonprofit in New Orleans that supports farmers and urban growers in the city and throughout the state. Increasingly, the food that Louisianans eat comes from out of state, and there's also like a decreasing amount of small vegetable farmers in the state. So we're really trying to support the ones who are interested and like growing that support. There's also increasing federal programs and federal support for small growers, but a lot of times it's difficult to access those resources without access to land and capital and markets and without infrastructure to support capacity building for those farmers. So we have technical assistance programs, we have grant making and infrastructure supports, we do a lot of climate change and policy work. We also have a reparations program for Black landowners in the state.
Climate change is, I guess, a big topic since Hurricane Katrina. It's been obvious that this state is very vulnerable to big weather events, big environmental events. How is climate change going to affect your farming in the future?
If you step over this way, I'll show you. Watch the mud.
There's no shortage
but
of mud.
I like the mud. I like it because I'm telling you, in the summer times around here, you're going to need this mud.
You've got a little ditch here.
That's not just a ditch. If you look in there, you'll see something else.
Oh, there's a pipe.
There's a pipe, exactly. This pipe is a part of climate change initiative that I have to do in order to build capacity to be able to farm, because at one point I could rely on weather patterns and use them scientifically based on averages to be able to plant and have a good estimate of what was going to happen. But with climate change, longer droughts, hotter summers, we have to have a different method of making sure we have irrigation for water. And this is a part of the water line. But actually, this water line comes from up near that house. I've got a series of pumps that I have to install, and I'll probably end up all the way to that train track with it. Now, on the other side of that train track, to that tree line that you see, the deep tree line, not this one right here.
The one at the back, yeah.
Highway 3127, that's the extent of my property. So I'll be farming over there, and I have already dug some ponds for irrigation there. So I had an idea that climate change was coming a long time ago, and I've been preparing for it and making sure that I can have access to water, because that's going to be really the crisis that's going to come out of climate change.
And this is another thing that Sprout is doing, is trying to leverage and disseminate funds for infrastructure like this. So in the past year, we've given about $40,000, and we're going to increase that amount a lot in the next 3 or 4 years for things like irrigation cisterns, equipment for digging ponds, but also like shade sails and fans for farm workers, because they're working in increasingly dangerous conditions.
Now, if you notice the smoke that's coming from those stacks over there, that's chemical plants, a lot of carbon being emitted, carcinogens.
So the context here is that, you know, between New Orleans and Baton Rouge, there's this stretch of the Mississippi River, and there's lots of petrochemical companies all the way along it. And we can see, we saw the big chimneys on the way in, you know, they're really obvious.
They're obvious, and you're fortunate not to see the emissions. I saw a couple of days ago, it was like horrible.
And do you feel that the petrochemical industry is kind of encroaching on the farmers? Does it feel like you're being kind of squeezed in by these big chemical companies?
Of course, their opportunity to buy cheap land in communities of color provides them with a motivation to increase capacity and increase profits.
So this land that's in front of us here?
Right, they're in the process of trying to purchase it right now. Large petrochemical industry to put fuel storage tanks. And I hate to see that happen, but if it does, it does. I'll continue farming. And we're not planning on selling out.
So you were describing earlier that, you know, as you're farming here, you're also helping the soil capture carbon, which is, you know, pulling it out of the atmosphere. But then there's all these petrochemical plants nearby that are putting carbon into the atmosphere. Do you feel you're, is this a kind of race? Are you competing against them, or are you just doing your thing?
Well, it's not a competition, because I can't compete on that level. However, by planting a lot, and by planting some trees, which I plan on doing, because trees are tremendous in terms of pulling in CO2 out of the air and sequestering it in the ground and allowing oxygen to be replenished. So hopefully we can plant more trees on farms in areas that we can, and also provide more plants that are going to help to provide more oxygen. The petrochemical industry is not going anywhere. They have a whole lot of lobbyists, and federal government's going to do what they need to do to facilitate that. And it's up to us individually to continue to fight. But when I say fight, continue to work towards creating a better environment.
I was wondering about the wildlife you see out here. Do you see animals crossing your land?
Yes.
What do you see?
There's a whole lot of life that would like to capture you. No, we have a lot of alligators. Now, we would have to go across that train track right there that you see. We go back there, there's some alligators back there.
I didn't know I was coming to see anywhere near alligators this morning.
We have what we call crawfish here. Some people call them crayfish. Well, I used to get a few because I made some traps, and I used to get crawfish out of there. And we'd bring them home and boil or stew them or whatever. And once I had enough of the alligators chasing me, I decided it wasn't worth getting the crawfish. But, yeah, they're pretty swift. You'd be surprised how quick they are. Right in that ravine by the train track, they had about maybe 20 or 30 little ones just swimming around. And underneath the bush, that was a big one I didn't see. And as I approached to get a closer look, the big one kind of opened up.
Oh.
I said, oh, well, that's close enough. So I had to get out of there. But anyway, yeah, there's a lot of wildlife And the good thing about that part of it is it's getting back to nature again. And it shows that the land is able to support an ecosystem, and that's important, because if it can support that, it can support us.
We're back inside now, and we're also joined by Leroy's wife, Gail, who's just given me this amazing lemonade. And is this sweetbread? What did you say this was?
Sweet potato pie.
Amazing. It looks fantastic. Just tell us a little bit. You're from this area, right? You're really local here.
Yes.
But tell us a little bit.
I actually was born and raised on the farm, which is about a half a mile down from here. My daddy was a sharecropper. He actually worked the farms. That's where we resided.
For the people in the UK who are not familiar with the term, just describe to us what sharecropping is.
Sharecropping is actually where the person that actually works the land for landowners, for the most part, who own sugarcane fields, there, I guess there's an agreement, if you would allow my family to live in a home that's already in that particular area, I will work for you in the farm. Now, of course, at that particular time, he definitely was compensated. It wasn't far back where it was slavery time, so no, it's not that far back. My dad worked that area in the 50s, I would say late 40s, early 50s. He drove tractors. He planted sugarcane for the people that he worked for, and of course we lived there. We lived pretty much from earth. He had his gardens. We had cattle, chickens.
And tell us a little bit about the history of a black ownership of land in this area.
That's quite rare.
Basically, if they own more than a quarter of the acre, that's rare.
Yeah, in this particular area.
And have there been things in the system which have made it harder specifically for black people to own land? I mean, has the system been fair to black people in that respect?
No. People in this particular area that had property, for example, my grandfather, my mother's father, so that was sold, I felt, from underneath us. A lot of, and I'm going to just be honest, Caucasian people that lived in this area, the whites, were working in the governmental system, so they were aware when African Americans were not able to pay their taxes, so they pulled that property from underneath them. So that happened in many instances throughout the river.
So in America more generally, compared with the percentage of African Americans in the population, what is the percentage of land ownership? Is it representative of the population?
In America in general, no. Historically, land ownership and homesteading was something that was available more so to Caucasians, to white people. And basically all they had to do was put a house up on a piece of land and they get so many acres. But at that particular time, not many blacks were able to benefit from that. And at this particular point in time, land is a premium, and there's a lot of land that's tied up in family issues. They didn't have a proper succession after the landowner passed away. Eventually, it basically goes back to the state, and then an individual would purchase it from the state for little or nothing. And normally, they would have these property sales in the middle of the week, about 9 or 10 o'clock in the day, whereas most people are working, and they'd have the sale when their friends were able to come over and then, you know, basically bid on the land and get it for little or nothing. In fact, my wife and I started to go to some of those.
Consider sheriff sales.
Sheriff sales. Mm-hmm. My wife and I started.
10 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. We started to go to some after we started going, and the people that were holding the land sales, they canceled the sales and said, hey, we're not going to have the sale today. The bank called and said that the property is off the market today. Mm-hmm. This whole system was designed to enrich people in power, political people. It's not so much a white or black thing, but it's more an economic opportunity for people with money, because a lot of the poor whites couldn't afford to get benefit from that process as well. But at the same time, when blacks start to benefit, then they'll change the rules a little bit. So it's one of those things. But we work around that. We don't let that deter us from doing what we're doing, because we see this as bigger than us, per se. I think Sprout has a program where they are doing reparations for black farmers. So that's a big part of land ownership again.
Amelia, this idea of the land reparations, how does that work in practice?
Over the last 2 years, we've given $500,000 to black residents of our community to purchase land or really necessary equipment for farming. And that was to address like the historic injustice and inequity and separation from the land. So some of the people who received those funds were able to purchase ancestral lands that they had been separated from and were able to return to.
Are you finding that young people are interested in taking advantage and of owning land and of being part of that readjustment?
Yeah. And we work, Sprout specifically works a lot with urban growers in the New Orleans area. And there's a lot of young people who want to pursue urban farming as a profession. And it's really hard to make it work when you're farming on lots of small plots, and it's hard to get even a 5 or 10 year lease on those plots. I've known a lot of growers who've had to pull up their irrigation lines and move their farms several times over the course of a few years. So having a stable access to land, even if it's a small plot near the city, can make a huge impact.
And Leroy, just finally, do you see that, you know, you can show people what you're doing with this land? You can show people that it's possible to build resilience to climate change, to farm for the benefit of community. Do you think people are interested in that and inspired by that, that there is a, you know, there's a hopeful future here?
There's a lot of youth that are interested in farming. In fact, I've been talking with some people at Sprout regarding mentorships and stipends for people to learn how to farm. And we can get urban farming out in the rural communities and get them trained up. And they can farm in the urban area, but they can also build capacity out in the rural communities where land is more available and less costly. So we had a gathering in Ville Platte with Sprout a couple of weeks ago, and that was farmers from all around the state, all around the country, and we all were exchanging ideas that were similar in terms of needs, trying to make a dysfunctional system more functional, where we can all have a concept and understand that by working together, we can create a better earth for everyone.
Well, we've been having this very serious discussion, and I've got this wonderful piece of sweet potato pie right in front of me. And I think this is a great place to finish, because, of course, the output of your farming is that people can sit around tables like this and they can enjoy meals with family and friends. And that is such a wonderful thing that, you know, you're doing. And it's so great to see the enthusiasm for it. So I'm going to get stuck into my sweet potato pie. And thank you very much for hosting us.
And thank you all for coming.
Thank you for having us. We appreciate the interest. We also appreciate the effort that you all are taking from an environmental standpoint, as well as from a point of giving farmers a platform to be able to tell the world what we need to do and why we need to do it and how it will benefit all of us.
Helen Chersky was on Your Farm in Louisiana with Leroy and Gail Konish. Now here on Radio 4, with the time approaching 7 o'clock, let's join Sarah Keith-Lucas for a look at what's in store with the weather.
Thank you, Danielle. Well, the weather isn't changing in a hurry at the moment. We've got a big area of high pressure sitting across central parts of Europe and the UK, and that is bringing us all that settled weather at the moment. It's also trapping quite a lot of cloud underneath the high pressure, so certainly not wall-to-wall sunshine out under that high pressure. It is looking fairly grey, but mild, light winds and largely dry. For England, Wales and Northern Ireland, I think any sunshine today will be fairly limited. It will brighten up a little bit. So this morning we've got some mistiness around some of the coasts and hills as well. So that should tend to clear away. Top temperatures here between around about 13 to 15 degrees with those light winds too. Odd spot of drizzle possible, particularly so for parts of the Midlands, perhaps Wales at times too. But most places will stay dry. For Scotland, though, today, it's here that we'll see a little bit more sunshine breaking through. So the cloud tending to break up, especially for central and eastern parts of Scotland, whereas further west, you're going to keep the slightly thicker cloud and the odd spot of drizzle around too. But as the sunshine comes through, we could see temperatures up to 15, possibly 16 degrees for the likes of Aberdeenshire, for instance. Now, across the UK tonight, another largely dry night with a lot of cloud around again. The lowest of the temperatures will be in the east with some clearer spells, so it could get down into mid-single figures. But I think most of us staying at around about 9 or 10 degrees under that cloud. Bit of mistiness to take us on into Monday morning. Overnight lows around about 10 or 12 for most in the west. Now, tomorrow, another largely dry, mild sort of day, light day, a lot of cloud around, but some sunny spells. And I think tomorrow we'll see a little bit more sunshine breaking through for parts of southeast England and Wales as well. Temperatures very similar to what we've got today, so up to about 14 or 15 degrees for most of us. And then as we head through the rest of the week, we've still got high pressure with us. It's just going to gradually shift its way a little bit further east, bringing a little change in wind direction. So I think particularly for Tuesday into Wednesday, watch out for some mist and some dense fog patches around for southern areas. They should clear away and then temperatures will be on the rise throughout the week.
Sarah Keith Lucas, thank you very much. Edward Sturton will be here with today's edition of Sunday from Atlanta just after the news, and to look at the front pages with Charles Carroll next. And then later this afternoon.
Dickensian on BBC Radio 4.
Brand new drama.
Your book, is it a love story?
A Charles Dickens novel, as relevant today as the day it was written.
It is not a love story, or I shouldn't be reading it. It's more about money than anything else.
A tale of the haves and have-nots, greed and intrigue.
This man's name was John Harmon.
Do you call it murder?
I do call it murder, sir.
Dickensian, Our Mutual Friend, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds this afternoon at 3.
BBC News at 7 o'clock on Sunday, the 3rd of November. Good morning, this is Charles Carroll. Kemi Badenoch is set to decide who'll be on her new front bench after winning the Conservative leadership contest. The two US presidential election candidates have been campaigning in North Carolina, a crucial state in Tuesday's vote, and extra soldiers and police officers are due to arrive in Spain's Valencia region, which was hit by deadly flash floods. The new Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, is beginning the process of choosing her shadow cabinet. She aims to have a team in place by Tuesday. Mrs. Badenoch has promised to renew the Tory party and to prepare for government, but has said that new policies and a plan for implementing them will take a few years to develop. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
Kemi Badenoch has said that her first responsibility is to hold Labour to account. For that, she'll need a new front bench in place. But some familiar faces and experienced ministers have ruled themselves out. The leadership contender and current Shadow Home Secretary, James Cleverly, has indicated that he's returning to the back benches. Joining him will be the Shadow Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, and fellow Shadow Cabinet members, Steve Barclay and Sir Oliver Dowden. During the leadership campaign, Mrs. Badenoch suggested her defeated rivals would be offered a place at the top table. But sources close to the new opposition leader told the BBC late last night that no job offers had yet been made. Her ambition is to remake what she regards as a broken system of government, and she wants, in her words, to see a state which does fewer things better. So far, she's largely avoided being drawn on the specifics. She's promised to consult with MPs, councillors and members. But Labour will try to deny her the political space to do so, with ministers preparing to press her to come up with alternatives to any government policies which she opposes.
The two candidates vying to be the next American president have both been holding rallies in one of the states which will decide the outcome, North Carolina. Polls indicate the race between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris is too close to call. Here's our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
Such is the importance of North Carolina, the candidates' planes were parked side by side on the tarmac at Charlotte Airport, while Donald Trump and Kamala Harris made their final appeals to voters. Mr. Trump won the state in 2016 and, narrowly, in 2020. But opinion polls suggest he's running neck and neck with Ms. Harris in one of the country's most competitive races. At the second of four rallies the former president is holding in the state this weekend, he told his supporters what to expect if he returned to the White House.
I will end inflation. I will stop the massive invasion of criminals into our country. And I will bring back the American dream.
During her rally in North Carolina, with the backing of celebrity guests including Jon Bon Jovi, Kamala Harris made her final pitch.
I pledge to you that if you give me the chance to fight on your behalf as president, there is nothing in the world that will stand in my way.
Kamala Harris's day ended with a surprise appearance on the long-running TV comedy show Saturday Night Live. More than 70 million Americans have now voted. The next 2 days will see the candidates making a final flurry of visits to the key battleground states, with the race on a knife edge.
The head of the Valencia region in Spain says electricity has now been restored to almost all the areas hit by deadly flash floods. But many districts are still without drinkable water. More than 200 people were killed and dozens more are missing. Our Southern Europe correspondent Mark Lowen reports from Valencia.
Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez has acknowledged the anger here from those furious that the flood warning came too late and the authorities' response has come too slow. Some of the 10,000 soldiers and police officers he's pledged will arrive today in Spain's biggest ever peacetime deployment of the military. They will encounter a devastated region. Entire neighbourhoods on the outskirts of Valencia remain caked in mud, the streets strewn with mangled cars, uprooted trees and the detritus of destroyed homes. Dozens are still missing as rescuers comb through underground car parks and tunnels in the hope less of finding survivors than retrieving the dead.
Detectives investigating allegations of historical sex offences made against Russell Brand have sent prosecutors a file of evidence so they can consider whether to charge him. The comedian and actor has been interviewed 3 times by police about the claims, which he's previously denied. Francis Reed has this report.
The allegations against Russell Brand emerged during an investigation last year by the Sunday Times, The Times and Channel 4's dispatches. They cover a 7-year period when he was at the height of his fame, starring in Hollywood films and holding several high-profile jobs, including at Channel 4 and at BBC Radio 2. The Metropolitan Police said it had received a number of reports of sexual offences from women following the original investigation and had interviewed Russell Brand 3 times. Detectives have now sent the Crown Prosecution Service a file of evidence so it can consider whether or not to bring charges. The CPS says any decision is made independently based on the evidence. Russell Brand has previously denied the allegations, calling them very, very hurtful.
Israel has denied that it was behind a strike which hit a polio vaccination clinic in northern Gaza, injuring 4 children. The vaccination program resumed yesterday. From Jerusalem, here's our correspondent John Donison.
The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, which is helping lead the vaccination campaign, said the blast which hit the Sheikh Radwan clinic in northern Gaza was another example of the indiscriminate strikes on civilians. Israel says it is investigating, but doesn't believe it was responsible. UNICEF says 50 children are reported to have been killed in Jabalia and northern Gaza in the past 2 days. Israel insists it is targeting Hamas. Meanwhile, the United States says several B-52 bombers have arrived in the Middle East, a day after the Pentagon announced their deployment as a warning to Iran. The Iranian leadership has vowed to retaliate for Israel's missile strikes on sites in the country last week.
People in Moldova are voting in the decisive second round of the presidential election, with the country's future direction at stake. The pro-Europe president, Maia Sandu, is facing Alexander Stoyanoglu, who is supported by the pro-Russian Socialist Party. A referendum 2 weeks ago narrowly backed a change to the constitution to include a wish for EU membership. Well, that's the news. Now a look at the newspapers. And Kemi Badenoch's conservative leadership victory features prominently on the front pages. It's time for a fresh start, is the headline in the Sunday Telegraph. In an interview with the paper, Mrs. Badenoch is said to have signalled that she will break from what she calls the mistakes of her predecessors. The Telegraph understands she'll sideline former Tory policies such as the drive towards net zero and anti-smoking legislation. It says one major challenge will be winning back the support of millions of Reform UK voters. The Sunday Times says Mrs. Badenoch has become the first black woman to lead a significant political party in Europe. The paper says she's expected to hand cabinet positions to loyal supporters such as Andrew Griffith, Claire Cotino, Alex Burkhardt and Julia Lopez. For the Sunday Times, her first major challenge is whether she will support the Chancellor's budget. The Observer has the headline, Labour challenges Badenoch over billions for public services. The paper says the government threw down an immediate challenge to Mrs. Badenoch to back Rachel Reeves' plans. It suggests a huge political divide threatens to open up between the Conservatives and Labour over economic policy and the future of public services. The Sunday Times leads with an investigation into the property empires owned by the King and the Prince of Wales. The paper says the duchies of Lancaster and Cornwall made a combined £51 million last year from the armed forces, the NHS, schools, mining companies and big businesses. It says the duchies imposed levies for the right to cross rivers, offload cargo, run cables under beaches and even to dig graves. The paper says the duchies operate as commercial landlords but are exempt from paying corporation or capital gains tax. The splash on the Sunday Mirror reads, Scandal of mouldy, hard-to-heat royal rentals. It says scores of properties owned by the Duchy of Cornwall are failing to meet energy standards and that tenants are complaining of damp homes that are so hard to keep warm, residents are ending up in fuel poverty. The Duchy says it's a responsible landlord committed to the continuous improvement of its properties. The Sunday Express has the headline, Fury over royal air farce. The paper says defence chiefs are warning against proposals being considered by the government's Strategic Defence Review, which could see all RAF pilots sent to the United States during their training because Britain is short of jets. The former Defence Secretary Sir Gavin Williamson says this would stop the UK from being able to train more pilots if it needed them for a conflict. And finally, moves to drop empire from King's honours is the headline in the Mail on Sunday. The paper says a biography of the King by the Mail writer Robert Hardman claims royal officials have held talks about losing the word. Under the plans, someone recognised with an OBE or Order of the British Empire could instead choose an Order of British Excellence. But the paper says the traditional colonial era titles would continue for those who wanted them. I'll look at Sunday's papers.
With Charles Carroll. And now on Radio 4, it's Sunday with Edward Sturton.
Welcome to Sunday. We are broadcasting live from the United States, a nation that in 2 days' time will vote for its next president. Religion has long been a big part of politics here, and we'll be examining the raw issues that pastors and politicians are talking about.
I don't want the government going with me to the doctor, and neither should you. There are some things that need to be kept between you, your God, and your doctor.
Abortion could be decisive, certainly for many women voters, and immigration is more divisive than ever.
And we're going to have open arms to vast majority of people who we know nothing about, where they come from. We're not taking our time on vetting them. If we were doing it properly, I wouldn't have a problem with it.
Here in Atlanta, we are at the heart of the struggle.
Hello to Georgia.
Good evening, Georgia!
Georgia. Georgia.
We've come to Georgia because with its 16 votes in the Electoral College, which will decide the outcome, it's an absolutely crucial battleground, and the polls suggest it's as tight as can be. Georgia helped to send Joe Biden to the White House last time, and there's still bad blood from that election, with Donald Trump facing the possibility of a criminal case here after he told a local official to find the votes needed to tip him over the winning line. We're also here because of the history of this state. The building just behind me is the Ebenezer Baptist Church, once the home church for a religious leader who changed the face of American politics, Martin Luther King.
And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Walk in the light. Beauty.
Well, Well, wow, I've just walked into the New Birth Missionary Baptist Church, which is a little way outside the centre of Atlanta, and the word vast doesn't really do it. It is jaw-dropping. It fits some 7,000 people on a Sunday morning. There's a vast dome above me. On my left, a huge stage with what looks like the musical instruments for almost a full orchestra behind this screen over here. And ranks of comfortable seats, I'd have to say, the sort of thing you'd find in a very smart cinema. Quite a setting for a Sunday service. And just in front of me is the place where only the other day Kamala Harris came, was welcomed, and appealed to the audience here.
The first black woman vice president of the United States. Would you make some noise and receive our fearless leader?
Good morning, church.
This church has a claim on the Martin Luther King legacy. The funeral of his widow, Coretta Scott King, took place here in the presence of four former presidents. Dr. Jamal Bryant is the senior pastor here.
It's Disney World goes to church. So it's a mammoth building. It holds about 6,500. But post-pandemic, we see more people online than we do in the building. We average on Sunday about 40,000 viewers. From literally around the world.
And what do you think it is about the character of Christianity or the preaching here that attracts so many people?
It is really a combination not just of ministry, but of service. We have been able to feed over 1 million people who are dealing with food insecurity that live in this region. We put about 100 young people through college every year. Home buyers workshop in community development and engagement.
You have, I can see very clearly on your shirt, a picture of Kamala Harris.
Yes.
Why? What is it about her that you admire?
Yeah, I think Kamala Harris exudes the Christian comportment of compassion that really exemplifies what the church is supposed to look like in our humanity, in a thrust to connect with divinity. And so while not a perfect candidate, is an exemplar of what grace is supposed to look like. And I feel a whole lot more comfortable putting the Bible beside her as opposed to her opposing candidate.
There are those who suggest that the measure of the strength of a leader is based on who you beat down, instead of what we know, which is the true measure of the strength of a leader is based on who you lift up.
As you know, many Christians feel the opposite. Many yes. Baptists particularly feel more comfortable with Donald Trump. What do you make of that?
Yeah, they are hanging their hat on one theological issue, more often than not around pro-life. The hypocrisy is their anti-abortion but pro the death sentence. And so I can't find the peace around that. You can't be pro-choice, but you're defunding prenatal care. You're defunding the teaching of black history and the banning of books of African-American contribution in this country.
And I ask this from the perspective of someone who comes from a country where religion and politics really don't mix at all, as you may know. In Britain, to what extent do you see direct political involvement, I mean, endorsing Kamala Harris, for example, yeah, as part of your Christian mission?
Yeah, I did my doctoral work at Oxford, Trinity College, and it is night and day between the church involvement in Great Britain and here, but it has been a long-standing part of the fabric of the black church to be politically involved and engaged. From the very beginning, I am a product of the AME Church, which is the African Methodist Episcopal Church, which is the nation's oldest black denomination that was started in 1787 out of Philadelphia, out of St. George's Episcopal Church. A group of black people were on their knees, and the ushers pulled them off of the altar because white congregants came late and wanted to make room for them to pray at the altar. The black people who had to sit in the balcony left out of church that day and started Bethel Laomi Church. I come out of that tradition. And so it is still touted, even in this hour, that the most segregated hour in America is still 11 o'clock on Sunday mornings. It is because of that that there is a black church.
One of the things we've been struck by is the evidence that Donald Trump seems to have made real progress with some young black men.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Yeah, is really the embracing short-sightedness of an anti-establishmentarian. When you unpack Project 2025 and how much of that is an affront to black men, the expansion of the death penalty that impacts black men, the removal of universal health care when black men have the highest mortality rate in the nation that impacts black men, the underfunding of historically black colleges and universities that impacts black men. You juxtapose that with Kamala Harris's plan to give forgivable loans to black men to start entrepreneurial enterprises. When you're looking at her program to look at what are the diseases that impact black men, the contrast is stark and glaring. And once you understand that the Bible is clear, people die from a lack of knowledge. So part of the responsibility of the church is to illumine where there are dark spots of ignorance.
Dr. Jamal Bryant, well, a third of Georgia's voters are black, a higher proportion than in any of the other battleground states. You might think Kamala Harris, the first woman of color to run for president, could count on the overwhelming majority. But listen to Vivian Childs, herself a pastor and an activist on behalf of Black Americans for Trump.
I am more about what someone does than what they say. Someone asked me, so how do you tell people, encourage them to vote for the president? And so I said, personalities are different among whoever it is, which means your opinion of someone may be totally different than mine. I've been married 52 years. I don't always agree with everything my husband said, but I love him just the same, okay? So what I say to them is, let's remove the candidates and let's look at the administrations. Do you remember what it looked like in 2016? First 3.5 years. Let's compare that to the first 3.5 years of 2020. Were your finances, were your amount of safety better in that first 3.5 years or where it is now? Depending on what you choose is what you're going to get in 2025 going forward. How do you choose?
Last time, the last presidential election, I think he got 10 or 11% of the black vote. How much will he get this time?
I don't know, but it's going to be nice. Many of the ones that I'm talking to are very encouraged. One of the gentlemen that I was speaking to just the other day, I said, what is making you vote for the President Trump this time? He's because my pockets are lighter today than they were in 2016. I love it.
President Trump is in a lot of people's minds associated with the idea of white nationalism through the evangelical churches and so forth. What's your reaction to that?
He's on a lot of people's mind because he's just out there. He's vibrant. He is a people person to me. I had dinner at Mar-a-Lago with him. I don't know how many people know that. There was a small group that we were invited, and they were students from black historical colleges. And every one of us that was sitting around his dinner table at Mar-a-Lago was asked, what did we feel about what he had done and what he could do? And he genuinely listened. There are some things that he would say that I would not. There are probably some things that he might do I would not. That is why I have to look at the policies. The policies of the party right now line up with what I teach out of my pulpit. And that is why he's getting my vote. A lot of the things that are happening in America does not line up with what I believe and what I teach. But the main thing I think that has me more than anything is illegal immigration. I'm not for illegal anything. I said, how different is that than if my neighbor down the street is hungry for his children? He has no money either. But if he go down to that store and walk out with a loaf of bread, he's going to face some judge. And he's an American. But we're going to allow someone else to cross the border, and we're going to give them benefits that people here live. And he'll put a stop to some of that.
There is a very deep Christian idea of giving people sanctuary.
I don't have a problem with that. I have lived overseas. If I do not have proper documentation, I'm not getting in. I don't care what I'm searching for. I don't care what I'm needing. You cannot do that. Why would I want any less for the country in which I live, where people can come over without documentation? Do I care for people that are struggling? Absolutely. That's what I do. People need a hands up, I'm there to give it. I just need you to follow the right procedures on doing things. It's not fair to the immigrants who are here, who are still waiting to take tests because they did everything properly, and we're going to have open arms to vast majority of people who we know nothing about, where they come from. We're not taking our time on vetting them. If we were doing it properly, I wouldn't have a problem with it.
Pastor Vivian Childs, well, none of the old certainties quite work in this election. Way back before the 1960s, when John Kennedy was elected as the first Catholic president, Catholics were reliable supporters of the Democratic Party. This time they are deeply, perhaps evenly divided, not least because many conservative Catholics support Donald Trump on abortion. Most Muslims would in normal circumstances vote Democrat, but many of them have turned against Kamala Harris because of the current administration's position on the war in Gaza. For a wider picture of the religious landscape, both here and in the nation as a whole, we turn to Professor Robert Franklin, Jr. of Emory University in Atlanta.
Georgia has a long history as a very Protestant, Southern, kind of Baptist, Methodist culture, and strong support of, let's call it a more conservative theological and ethical agenda that translates itself into politics.
Most of the listeners to this live in a country where politics loathes religion. I mean, if you confess your faith, you're almost certainly going to get into trouble. And in the recent general election we had, it didn't feature at all. We had a Hindu prime minister, but you know, that none of that really featured. But here it seems that religion is soaked into the system, both in terms of the values people have and what that makes them decide, but also institutionally, so that you have churches campaigning for individual candidates. Can you just talk us through that?
Well, going back to the founding of the American Republic, there's always a vigorous debate, and I would say outright tension, between at least two schools of thought. Those who believe that America should be a place where people of all faith affiliations and none at all could freely participate in American civic life, could run for office, could govern, and without reference at all to their religious affiliations and loyalties. And I call that the tradition of civic virtue. The other tradition, more the Christian sectarian tradition, was that people should first declare themselves to be loyal to God, to a particular representation of morality, and a set of practices, church going on Sunday, for instance, refraining from consuming alcohol, closing society down on Sundays, the tradition known as Sabbatarianism. And so that has been deeply baked into American culture, not the one tradition, Christian virtue or the civic virtue I'm describing, but rather both are there in tension nearly all the time. And so I think that part of what we see from election to election is the argument between these two traditions. And since the 1980s and the ascendance of Ronald Reagan, that latter tradition, the sort of tradition of public Christian virtue on display, some would say on steroids, has had a far more prominent role.
You spoke about the Southern Baptist Church in Georgia, and that has become increasingly, for many people, identified with support for Donald Trump turning to the current election. Do you think that will be as strong this time as it was last time?
the largest denomination in American life today is the Southern Baptist Church. That's the largest Protestant, I should say. Of course, the very largest, the single largest, is a Catholic tradition and identity in America. But second to that, the largest Protestant is Southern Baptist. That tradition used to hold government accountable, used to criticize elected officials who were not good family people, men in this case, for a long time, a strong private moral agenda. And after the 80s and the taste of power, many felt that the Southern Baptists and most evangelicals were a bit seduced by access to the White House, by access to power. They liked it enough that they were willing to compromise previous moral agendas. So that in part explains how a person like Donald Trump, with all of his personal contradictions, can emerge not as a leader, exemplar of faith or Christian piety, but as a man who knows how to acquire power and use it for the benefit of his friends.
A lot of people see a particular version of it having morphed into something they call Christian nationalism, which usually means Christian white nationalism. Do you think that's fair, and does that worry you?
Many of the evangelical, charismatic, Pentecostal, more conservative Christian leaders have moved from a private endorsement to now, again, these full-throated endorsements, and not just an endorsement. This is who I, you know, Trump is my guy. I'm going to stand with him, pray for him, support him, but demonizing the other side. I've been shocked to hear commercials and communications that speak of the Vice President Harris as anti-Christ and contrary to American values and on and on. It just goes overboard. And I think this is the toxic influence of a brand of Christian nationalism that is a take-no-prisoner will to power.
A couple of questions about other denominations. I know Catholics are quite a small minority here, but as you said, nationally, they're anything but that, and a number of the Supreme Court judges who made the crucial decision on Roe versus Wade are Catholic, but they seem, as a community, quite deeply split at the moment. Is that fair?
I think it is, and I think that the emergence of Pope Francis as a voice willing to listen to the other side, so to speak, is a fragile but growing tradition, if you will. I mean, we look at Joe Biden as, you know, a good Catholic believer, but who also was able to declare support for Roe versus Wade, for instance, in terms of the American debate about abortion. He was a Catholic president weighing in and leading a position of moderation, tolerance for difference, etc. His side has been losing in the Catholic Church. But I think the pendulum is starting to swing. And I hear my Catholic friends quote Pope Francis when they say, you know, I believe this, say I'm against abortion, I'm pro-life, on and on. But who am I to judge? I will pray for them. I think they're lost. But I will not become an adversary. So it's an interesting time. A lot of ambiguity in this season in the Catholic tradition.
Well, another bit of ambiguity perhaps surrounds groups of voters who traditionally were thought usually to be Democrats, Jews, and certainly Muslims more recently. That, again, may well change radically this time round because of what's happening both among the Jewish community and indeed among Muslims.
Yeah, this is fascinating to see what are likely to be some realignments. But I perceive creative tension in each of these communities, Christian, Muslim, and Jewish communities. And I'm finding that the most persuasive voices tend to be those who are calling for a return to first principles. What is just? What is good? What is right? And to support people who endorse a foreign policy that shows fairness to both sides, which is to say support for Israel and its security, but also some open and explicit commitment to helping Palestinian people find a life of dignity. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out. And, of course, there are certain sectors of the voting population in America where we'll be able to quickly tell what, you know, Muslim communities in Michigan decided to do in this race.
Robert Franklin talking to me earlier. The time is 27 minutes to 8. If you've just joined us, you're listening to a special edition of Sunday, broadcast live from the American state of Georgia. If anything stirs you to get in touch, our email is sunday@bbc.co.uk, and we're on social media at @BBCR4Sunday. And we will be coming back to American politics next weekend after the election. We heard Professor Franklin there talk about the importance of conservative Christians in this election. So here's an example of that voice.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the Leading the Way YouTube channel. I am so glad you connected with us. You know, this is one of several media platforms where we share the gospel.
I'm with Dr. Michael Youssef, who's the senior pastor of the Church of the Apostle in Atlanta. And we're sitting in comfortable chairs in front of a fireplace with logs in the grate and a mantelpiece with candles and a cross. Yeah. And this is the set from which you broadcast. Right. Tell me a little bit about the broadcasting operation.
Sure. We will broadcast directly from the Church of the Apostles on Sunday morning programs. Here, I do the opening and the closing in the studio. I do a lot of the television specials.
And what sort of an audience do you reach worldwide?
Well, there is no telling, really, because in addition to being on all the three networks in Australia, for example, and in England with TV in UK and God TV and so on, or Canada and a lot of television stations there, we have our own dedicated television station called Kingdom Sat, Malakot in Arabic, and it's in 260 million homes in the Arab world.
Okay, let's talk about the election. Yes. Why do you support Donald Trump?
Who said that I support Donald Trump? I look at policies. I don't necessarily look at the individuals. I look at policies. The policies, is it consistent with my Christian values or are they not? And if they are consistent with my Christian value, that's how I vote. The economy is important, but not to me. To me, much more important is my moral values.
And to be clear, what is it about Donald Trump's policies that chime with your moral values?
Well, I'll give you an example. I'm a grandfather of 15. And how painful it would be for one of my granddaughters be allowed to have a pervert man go into her locker room and the bathroom and play against him. And that was a executive order that Obama signed. Trump immediately came and he signed an executive order against that. So the boys be in their boys' space and the girls will be in girls' space. So that's important to me as a grandfather.
You say you don't really vote for a personality, but can you not judge someone by what they do and what they say? So Donald Trump is foul-mouthed.
Yep.
He uses four-letter words in front of big crowds.
Yep.
Is that really the way for a president who's supposed to be an example to your grandchildren? Yeah. Is that the way that a president should carry on?
He's not an example. I don't hold him as an example. Listen, if I'm voting for a pastor, if I'm voting for a Sunday school teacher, he would not be on the list. But I want to know what policies he's going to implement. And you know, the Bible makes it very clear. Government has only one job. It's not welfare and it's not social security, it's not this and it's not. It's to protect the citizenry, according to Romans 13. That's the one job that the government has. And so is that person protecting the citizenry? 10 million people walking through the borders, many of them are murderers and child abusers and they're creating havoc in the cities of the United States.
Well, there are those, of course, who would say that that's a rather inaccurate picture of what's happening with immigration at the moment. But what about the way he talks about immigrants, suggesting that murdering is in your genes? Is there not a danger that he stirs up hatred against people, which surely is something you would worry about?
I think he was basically enunciating the danger of unfitted immigrant. Now I'm an immigrant. But I lined up in the embassy. I lined up like everybody else. But just to walk across unvetted, and that's really what he's attacking.
All right, let's talk a bit more about policies, specifically abortion. I assume that you are happy about the way the Supreme Court has changed the position on that.
Yes. Yeah.
Why do you think that's so important?
It is so important because I'm almost got aborted myself. My mother had six children. Even though we could afford it, it's not the issue of money for us, it was, but her health. And this is a long story, but I tell you very quickly, the three doctors basically said, you have to have an abortion, otherwise you will not make it. But through the intervention of our pastor, now this is back in 48, she went by faith, trusting God that he will bring me through. So I know how grateful I am.
Can I explore a bit what you mean by the phrase, you call yourself pro-lifer?
Yes.
Does that simply mean someone who opposes abortion?
Well, I'm saying I'm pro-life because I am for life. That's the important part.
Well, how does that play, for example, in the area of the death penalty?
Yes.
Where do you stand on that?
Oh, I have no problem with that at all. The government, God, basically has raised governments, again, Romans 13, very clear, to exercise justice. Now, here's the problem. In our mishmash and sentimental Western civilization that we have come into now, we have wanted a government to love and cuddle criminals when they're supposed to exercise justice. Now, I exercise mercy. You and I exercise love and mercy and grace and forgiveness, but not the government. And so that is where I make the distinction.
What about guns in a country where thousands of people are killed every year by guns? And a lot of people, including the Pope, actually, look at that kind of thing and say, well, if you're really pro-life, you should be in favor of gun control.
This is the United States. This is the Second Amendment, and they cherish that. And I don't come here as a foreigner telling them what to do. If it's an amendment in the Constitution and you want to repeal it, do it exactly the right way prescribed in the Constitution to repeal it. And the problem is when these things happen, you take the guns out. Look what's happening in England. The stabbings. I mean, that's just as bad as a gun.
Well, it isn't as bad as a gun, isn't it? Because
it's life lost.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there were three little girls killed in a terrible incident.
But I'm talking about others.
Well, there aren't very many. I mean, that's kind of the point, isn't it? When people don't have guns, they can't kill so many people.
Yeah. Well, again, I'm a naturalized citizen of the United States, and if the Second Amendment calls for people, good people, honest people, to protect themselves by having a gun, I am not going to come here and pontificate and tell them what to do.
Can I ask you about the assassination attempt against Donald Trump? What's your interpretation of that event?
I've been quoted by the former Speaker of the House, Gingrich, and I said that the providence of God has saved him. And it was quoted all over the press, all over the world. And I really believe that. I said God saved him for a reason. And I think if you notice very closely that he's literally being changed before our eyes. We're seeing some moderation that we have not seen before. And that is, I think, his conviction that God somehow protected him and saved him from certain death. I mean, literally, it would be just 2 seconds and he'd be dead.
Is there a theological problem that, because somebody was killed, Corey Comparator.
Yes.
Well, where was God's providence there?
Sure. Well, you know, there's no greater love than someone lay his life for a friend. And what about all the people, the millions of Americans who died in Second World War and the First World War and for the sake of the freedom of the country?
But if you're right, the implication is that God has a very special plan for Donald Trump. You really believe that?
Well, God has a special plan for all of us. And therefore, if God spared Trump, these are the questions we'll never understand until we get to heaven. Why somebody dies, somebody doesn't. But at least when that happens, you have to ask the question, God, you did this for me. Why? How can I serve you better? How can I use my life to impact for good the lives of others?
Dr. Youssef. Well, Georgia is one of the states that has introduced tough abortion restrictions since the Supreme Court made that possible. The state has what's known as a heartbeat law, which, with some exceptions, bans abortion after 6 weeks. There's been one notorious death since the new rules came in. A young woman traveled to a neighboring state to take abortion pills. When she returned to Georgia, she contracted an infection and died because doctors wouldn't treat her. Tara Butler speaks for Supermajority, a group campaigning to build support among women for Vice President Harris because of this issue.
Georgia has one of the strictest anti-abortion laws in the country, and that has had a huge impact, especially stories of mothers bleeding out in cars, being denied access to reproductive health care. And that is something that is seeping into not only like the political lexicon, but these are the conversations that people are having at the grocery store, at the gas station, and it's conversations people are having within church. I think the case that resonates is the Amber Thurman case, a young Black mother who sought care for a miscarriage and went to hospital and was denied that care. If she had received reproductive health care, she would be with us today.
And just to be clear, so that I understand this right, was the reason she wasn't given care that doctors are frightened of the implications of the law?
Absolutely. It is because doctors are frightened and they are threatened with either jail time, they risk losing their insurance or having their medical license challenged. They don't want to take the risk. And if you think about it, hospitals don't want to take that risk either.
How much movement has there been of women leaving their states and their homes because they can't access abortion?
I'll give you an example. In Michigan, Michigan has strong reproductive health care protections. But because of the influx of people from neighboring state where they do have restrictions, it's harder for people within Michigan to get appointments. And I call it a crisis because anytime a woman has to put her life in danger and is denied care, that is a crisis. And for these women who are experiencing that, if they're having an ectopic pregnancy, if they find themselves in a situation where it's the life of the mother or something along those lines, where do they go? And the impact for a state like Georgia or a state like North Carolina, even Virginia and in the southern states where you have large rural populations, where you don't have an emergency medical facility that is within the driving distance of these smaller towns, those are crucial minutes. And it is a matter of life and death.
You said that these conversations are now taking place in church, even if you like. Do you accept the good faith of those who take such a very different view in a place like Georgia for reasons of their beliefs, people who really do think that the sanctity of life is so important that something like the Georgia law is right?
I have to say that I grew up and identify as a Christian, and I do have quite a few friends, and we do not agree on this particular issue. And it is complicated. And oftentimes what I have found is you don't think about it until it happens to you or it happens to someone that you know. And then all of a sudden you begin to question those things. But these are deeply held beliefs. But what I often say is that I don't want the government in my bedroom, and neither should you. I don't want the government going with me to the doctor, and neither should you. There are some things that need to be kept between you, your God, and your doctor.
A lot of the polling and a lot of the evidence from early voting suggests that women are significantly more likely to vote for Kamala Harris than men. And there's a famous quote from Eleanor Roosevelt that in the end, it's up to the women. Do you think that's what's going to decide this election?
I'm going to take it one step further. I don't think it's just up to the women. I think it's going to be young women that are going to make the difference in this election, because young women are the first generation, especially Gen Z. They're the first generation to not have rights, to see their rights consistently taken away. And they are motivated.
Jara Butler. And what, finally, of what many see as Donald Trump's trump card, immigration? I lunched with a multi-faith group of supporters for what's known as the Sanctuary Movement, which looks after immigrants.
My name is Reverend Tom Haygood. I'm the pastor of Columbia Presbyterian Church and the moderator of the New Sanctuary Movement of Atlanta.
I'm Rabbi Ari Kamen at Congregation Cherith Israel in Atlanta and have partnered with these wonderful fellows in the work of the New Sanctuary Movement.
Hi, my name is Anand Saulani, and I'm a asylum seeker, and I live in Columbia Presbyterian Church.
I'm Kiran Nawani, and I'm one of the asylum seekers and currently residing at Columbia Presbyterian Church.
And we are at the Marley House with a very appealing menu here. Lots of very good local delicacies by the look of it. We're just up the road from the church. You all talked about the New Sanctuary Movement. Just talk a little bit about the origins.
The state of Georgia, there are organizations in Georgia that have been involved since the 80s. But we, as the New Sanctuary Movement of Atlanta, did not really begin until 2017. I think there's a reason for that, to be honest with you. That was during the initial points when Trump was elected. And what we did as a congregation was look around and say, who needs support? So we decided that we would help them, and the church actually decided it would become a sanctuary church, which meant if there was somebody who was going to be deported, but they needed more time for their legal process to happen, they could live in the church, actually. They wouldn't be able to leave during that time, but we were going to offer sanctuary. The only trouble is, in the state of Georgia, almost 95% of the cases end up with the immigrant being deported. And so over the years, we have had asylum seekers who had no place to go, who were trying to make ends meet somehow, that have lived in Columbia Presbyterian Church over the years.
Karen and Alan, tell us how you came here.
We came in 2020 in October, but when we came, we have some problem at the airport. After that, she was released, and I was in the detention center for 4 months. So I got released on parole after 4 months. Then I came to Atlanta, and from then I've been staying at Columbian Presbyterian for the last 3 years.
Can I ask you why you decided to come here?
As we belong to minority, and like Pakistan is a Muslim country, so like it's really difficult to survive over there. When my husband got attacked, because he belonged to some political party as well, when he got attacked a couple of times, so after that, like, and we started receiving some threats, so then at that point we decided to just leave Pakistan.
We are in the middle of an election campaign in which the issue of immigration is absolutely at the center of things. And clearly there's a very strong feeling among lots of people in the country that illegal immigration is wrong, and some very tough stuff has been said, particularly by Donald Trump, about illegal immigration. Ari, what's your response to that?
When I think about people who are fleeing for their lives, and I think about what a nation's responsibility is to people seeking safety, of course there's a balancing act that we as a nation must engage in. Of course we need to have a responsible process. Of course we need to do better at the work of encountering human beings who look to our great country and say, can it be home for me too? And I don't know of any American who fits the characterizations that there's a belief that all of our borders should be purely open. At least for me, I want politicians who want to do good for good's sake. And it doesn't matter to me if they're Republican or if they're Democrats or if they're liberals or conservatives. The history of our country is a country in which we were able to debate these matters with respect for one another and a common interest in mind.
That some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations.
Martin Luther King's greatest hits are played on a loop over the little memorial garden here, just across the road from the church where he preached. And I'm standing next to an eternal flame, which is supposed to bear witness to his efforts to realize his ideals. What would he have made of this election? Well, he might well agree on something we've heard from both sides, there is a huge amount at stake on Tuesday.
I think the land of the free and the home of the brave is at stake. I think the Constitution is at stake. I think democracy is on trial. I think decency and integrity are on the ballot. I think character is on the slate. And so I think all of the things that America boasts and love and celebrate are really at stake.
I lived under persecution, and if I have to be persecuted again, I can live with it. I know how to live under persecution. It's okay. But my grandchildren is what worry me, that they will lose their freedom once a socialist government sets in.
Leaders set a tone. They set the tone at the top for the entire nation and perhaps for much of the world. And a leader that is thoughtful, that is intelligent, who listens, who is tolerant and kind and compassionate, can go a long way toward helping the larger world perhaps exhale, take a breath, pause, and figure out how do we learn to live with neighbors who are different.
Keeps Georgia on my mind.
And that is it for this US election special from Atlanta. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thanks, Edward. Edward Sturton with Sunday, which was produced by Dan Tierney in Atlanta and Catherine Murray and Sabah Zuman in our Salford studio. And now Fiona Spargo-Mabbs, founder of the Daniel Spargo-Mabbs Foundation, makes this week's Radio 4 appeal on behalf of the charity.
When my son Dan was 16, he asked to go to a party. Dan was in a great place at the time, doing really well at school, voted prom king by his year group, part of the youth work at church. So after the usual questions, where's the party, when will you be back, I said he could go. Before he set off that Friday night, he gave me a hug and said what he always did. I love you, Mom, I promise I won't die. It was his joke. In the early hours, there was a knock at the door. The moment every parent dreads. The police said Dan had been found unconscious at a rave and been taken to hospital. They suspected he'd taken ecstasy. The next 2 days were spent at Dan's side in intensive care, with his big brother Jacob and my husband Tim willing him to live. Tests showed the ecstasy he'd taken had been incredibly strong, and there was nothing doctors could do. He had multiple organ failure, and on the Monday, he died. Losing Dan made me realise just how close drugs are to young people, and that's what research suggests too. NHS data shows that if you know a 15-year-old, there's a 50% chance they will have been offered drugs, with 1 in 3 saying yes. But Dan's friends told us they'd had little education about drugs. I don't believe Dan properly understood the risks that night. And that's why Tim and I started the Daniel Spargo-Mabbs Foundation. We go into schools across England and Scotland and provide drug education to young people, parents and professionals through workshops, training and drama. We want other kids to make safer choices. Maybe Dan would still be with us if he'd gone through our programme. A workshop costs £180 and it's our aim to reach every young person in the UK. So anything you can give today will help. And the first £12,000 of donations you give will be matched by a group of generous supporters. You can give now. Just search online for BBC Radio 4 Appeal or you can call 0800 404 8144. That's 0800 404 8144. Or you can write a cheque to DSM Foundation and send it to Free Post, BBC Radio 4 Appeal. That's the whole address. And importantly, please mark the back of the envelope DSM Foundation. From Tim, Jacob and me and our dear son Dan, a very big warm-hearted thank you.
Fiona Spargo-Mabbs. The calls are free from landlines and mobiles. You can find all the details for giving online if you search for BBC Radio 4 Appeal. Remember that if you're a UK taxpayer and if you want DSM Foundation to collect the gift aid on your donation, please include an email or postal address so they can send you a gift aid declaration. Now on Radio 4 with the weather forecast, here's Sarah Keith Lucas.
Thank you, Danielle. We've got a big area of high pressure in charge of our weather at the moment, and it's not going anywhere in a hurry, so the weather really not changing very much day to day at the moment. Largely dry and settled, mild for the time of year, but we have got a lot of cloud trapped under that high pressure. So today, best of the sunshine will be across parts of Scotland, particularly central and eastern Scotland. Here, some long spells of blue sky developing, in fact. But for the rest of the UK, I think only glimpses of blue sky, any sunshine in short supply. Fairly light winds coming in from south or southeast, and that's going to lift temperatures to somewhere between about 12 to 15 degrees today. There's a little bit of mistiness around some coasts and over the hills first thing this morning, but that should tend to disappear. Things brightening up, the cloud just lifting a little bit. And then into the evening hours, it stays dry and again pretty cloudy, as does the overnight period as well. The clearest skies tonight will be across the northeast of Scotland again, so it's here that they'll fall those temperatures into mid-single figures. But I think most of us looking at about 8 to 10 degrees overnight, perhaps a touch cooler than some recent nights. Into Monday, and it's more of the same again, another largely dry, cloudy, mild sort of day. But I think tomorrow the cloud will tend to thin and break a little bit better compared to recent days. So that means a little bit more sunshine tomorrow, especially so for parts of southeast England, perhaps Wales later on, western Scotland also seeing a little bit more sunshine as well, and temperatures similar to today, around 12 to 15 degrees. From midweek onwards, though, do watch out for some fairly dense fog patches, especially Tuesday and Wednesday mornings across the southern half of the UK. So mist and fog becoming more of a feature through the middle part of the week. It should improve later in the week, and those temperatures will be on the rise by a few degrees.
Sarah, thank you. Sunday worship after the news comes from the ruins of Byland Abbey in North Yorkshire. And then at 9 o'clock, it's Broadcasting House with Simon Jack. Morning, Simon.
Good morning. Yes, as we hurtle towards the US election, we hear from ex-soldier, current congressman and Trump confidant on what foreign policy might look like under Donald 2.0, and hear from the host of Have I Got News For You, the US version, on finding laughs among bitter divisions. Michael Gove will tell us why his protege, Kemi Badenoch, is the right person to mount a Tory comeback. And we also speak to a big business beast about the budget. Seb James hung up his boots as boss of Boots on Friday. And of course, we'll have the best of the papers with our headliners at 9 o'clock.
BBC News at 8 o'clock on Sunday, the 3rd of November. Good morning, this is Charles Carroll. Kemi Badenoch is starting work on choosing her front bench team after winning the Conservative leadership race. Campaigning in the US presidential election has moved to North Carolina, which could be decisive in Tuesday's vote, and Israel has denied carrying out a strike which hit a polio vaccination clinic in northern Gaza. The new Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, is beginning the process of choosing her shadow cabinet. She aims to have a team in place by Tuesday. Mrs. Badenoch has promised to renew the Tory party and to prepare for government, but has said that new policies and a plan for implementing them will take a few years to develop. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
Kemi Badenoch has said that her first responsibility is to hold Labour to account. For that, she'll need a new front bench in place. But some familiar faces and experienced ministers have ruled themselves out. The leadership contender and current Shadow Home Secretary, James Cleverly, has indicated that he's returning to the back benches. Joining him will be the Shadow Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, and fellow Shadow Cabinet members, Steve Barclay and Sir Oliver Dowden. During the leadership campaign, Mrs. Badenoch suggested her defeated rivals would be offered a place at the top table. But sources close to the new opposition leader told the BBC late last night that no job offers had yet been made. Her ambition is to remake what she regards as a broken system of government, and she wants, in her words, to see a state which does fewer things better. So far, she's largely avoided being drawn on the specifics. She's promised to consult with MPs, councillors and members. But Labour will try to deny her the political space to do so, with ministers preparing to press her to come up with alternatives to any government policies which she opposes.
The two candidates vying to be the next American president have both been holding rallies in one of the states which will decide the outcome, North Carolina. Polls indicate the race between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris is too close to call. Here's our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
Such is the importance of North Carolina, the candidates' planes were parked side by side on the tarmac at Charlotte Airport, while Donald Trump and Kamala Harris made their final appeals to voters. Mr. Trump won the state in 2016 and, narrowly, in 2020. But opinion polls suggest he's running neck and neck with Ms. Harris in one of the country's most competitive races. At the second of four rallies the former president is holding in the state this weekend, he told his supporters what to expect if he returned to the White House.
I will end inflation. I will stop the massive invasion of criminals into our country. And I will bring back the American dream.
During her rally in North Carolina, with the backing of celebrity guests including Jon Bon Jovi, Kamala Harris made her final pitch.
I pledge to you that if you give me the chance to fight on your behalf as president, there is nothing in the world that will stand in my way.
Kamala Harris's day ended with a surprise appearance on the long-running TV comedy show Saturday Night Live. More than 70 million Americans have now voted. The next 2 days will see the candidates making a final flurry of visits to the key battleground states, with the race on a knife edge.
The head of the Valencia region in Spain says electricity has now been restored to almost all the areas hit by deadly flash floods, but many districts are still without drinkable water. More than 200 people were killed and dozens more are missing. Our Southern Europe correspondent Mark Lowen reports from Valencia.
Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez has acknowledged the anger here from those furious that the flood warning came too late and the authorities' response has come too slow. Some of the 10,000 soldiers and police officers he's pledged will arrive today in Spain's biggest ever peacetime deployment of the military. They will encounter a devastated region. Entire neighbourhoods on the outskirts of Valencia remain caked in mud, the streets strewn with mangled cars, uprooted trees and the detritus of destroyed homes. Dozens are still missing as rescuers comb through underground car parks and tunnels in the hope less of finding survivors than retrieving the dead.
Prosecutors are considering whether to charge the comedian Russell Brand following allegations of historical sexual abuse. The Crown Prosecution Service has received a file of evidence from the Metropolitan Police. Last year, a Channel 4 and Sunday Times investigation alleged that four women had accused Mr. Brand of sexual assaults between 2006 and 2013. He denies wrongdoing. Israel has denied that it was behind a strike which hit a polio vaccination clinic in northern Gaza, injuring four children. The vaccination program resumed yesterday. From Jerusalem, here's our correspondent John Donison.
The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, which is helping lead the vaccination campaign, said the blast which hit the Sheikh Radwan clinic in northern Gaza was another example of the indiscriminate strikes on civilians. Israel says it is investigating, but doesn't believe it was responsible. UNICEF says 50 children are reported to have been killed in Jabalia in northern Gaza in the past 2 days. Israel insists it is targeting Hamas. Meanwhile, the United States says several B-52 bombers have arrived in the Middle East, a day after the Pentagon announced their deployment as a warning to Iran. The Iranian leadership has vowed to retaliate for Israel's missile strikes on sites in the country last week.
People in Moldova are voting in the decisive second round of the presidential election, with the country's future direction at stake. The pro-Europe president, Maia Sandu, is facing Alexander Stoyanoglu, who is supported by the pro-Russian Socialist Party. More details from Warren Bull.
Moldova is one of Europe's poorest countries and a former Soviet republic, wedged between Ukraine and Romania. Since becoming its first female president 4 years ago, Maia Sandu has moved Moldova more towards Brussels than Moscow. A referendum 2 weeks ago narrowly supported a change to the constitution to include a wish for European Union membership. That vote was much closer than expected, as was the first round presidential vote on the same day. They prompted accusations by the police of a large-scale attempt orchestrated from Russia to bribe Moldovans to vote for any candidate but Maia Sandu, an accusation opposition candidates rejected. But with the stakes and tensions in Moldova high, the head of the Election Commission has ruled that any election officials accused of corruption in the first round vote will not have a role in the runoff.
Well, that's the news this morning. Now we'll have a look at the Sunday papers. And Kemi Badenoch's Conservative leadership victory features prominently on the front pages. "It's time for a fresh start," is the headline in the Sunday Telegraph. In an interview with the paper, Mrs. Badenoch is said to have signalled that she will break from what she calls the mistakes of her predecessors. The Telegraph understands she'll sideline former Tory policies such as the drive towards net zero and anti-smoking legislation. It says one major challenge will be winning back the support of millions of Reform UK voters. The Sunday Times says Mrs. Badenoch has become the first black woman to lead a significant political party in Europe. The paper says she's expected to hand cabinet positions to loyal supporters such as Andrew Griffith, Claire Catino, Alex Burghardt and Julia Lopez. For the Sunday Times, her first major challenge is whether to support the Chancellor's budget. Well, that topic is taken up as the lead in The Observer. The paper says the government threw down an immediate challenge to Mrs. Badenoch to back Rachel Reeves' plans. It suggests a huge political divide threatens to open up between the Conservatives and Labour over economic policy and the future of public services. The Sunday Times leads with an investigation into the property empires owned by the King and the Prince of Wales. The paper says the duchies of Lancaster and Cornwall made a combined £51 million last year from the armed forces, the NHS, schools, mining companies and big businesses. It says the duchies imposed levies for the right to cross rivers, offload cargo, run cables under beaches and even to dig graves. The paper says the duchies operate as commercial landlords but are exempt from paying corporation or capital gains tax. The Sunday Mirror's headline is "Scandal of Mouldy Hard-to-Heat Royal Rentals." It says scores of properties owned by the Duchy of Cornwall are failing to meet energy standards and that tenants are complaining of damp homes that are so hard to keep warm, residents are ending up in fuel poverty. The duchy says that it's a responsible landlord committed to the continuous improvement of its properties. The Sunday Express has the headline "Fury over Royal Air Farce." The paper says defence chiefs are warning against proposals being considered by the government's Strategic Defence Review, which could see all RAF pilots sent to the United States during their training because Britain is short of jets. The former Defence Secretary Sir Gavin Williamson says this would stop the UK being able to train more pilots if it needed them for a conflict. "Moves to drop empire from King's honours" is the headline in the Mail on Sunday. The paper says a biography of the King by the Mail writer Robert Hardman claims royal officials have held talks about losing the word. Under the plans, someone recognised with an OBE, or Order of the British Empire, could instead choose an Order of British Excellence. I'll look at the Sunday papers.
With Charles Carroll. And now on Radio 4, it's time for Sunday Worship, recorded at Byland Abbey in North Yorkshire.
Good morning. For today's Sunday worship, we are being sheltered by the rolling hills of northern England, somewhere off the beaten tracks between the town of Thirsk and the city of York. I'm Father Dermot Preston, and in the dale before me are the ruins of Byland Abbey, just one in the cluster of remarkable Christian monasteries established in the 12th century here in the wilderness of North Yorkshire. The Cistercian monks who came here had left Furness Abbey, just south of the Lake District, in search of a remote place to build a permanent house of prayer. The journey had been long and arduous, but from the moment they arrived in Byland, on the Eve of All Hallows, 1177, their prayers mingled with the sounds of construction as they chipped at the rocks, cleared the ground and hauled and stacked the stones, eventually building an outstanding house of prayer and worship, where, as they wrote, "God willing, we will remain." Sadly, little remains of that bustling abbey today. There is a strong footprint in the Yorkshire soil, and some of the locally mined limestone arches and walls stand defiant, giving a hint of the original shape. But the roofs have been stripped, and the monastery lies corroded and open to the elements. We will, however, be able to look at some manuscripts which survived the abbey's destruction, and in particular to ponder the Byland ghost stories, startling medieval tales through which we can catch a glimpse of thoughts on death and dying in those distant times. Our worship today is all about saints, souls, and spirits, and Byland is a rich source of reflection on all three. We are close to the triduum of Halloween, All Saints, All Souls, which opened the month of November, a month which is the traditional time when Christians remember and pray for the dead. So let us pray. Lord, although our bodies are rooted in the world, our spirits allow us to touch eternity. As we consider this house of prayer and shelter, give us a knowledge of your presence in the saints, souls, and spirits who have walked this pilgrim road before us and still cast a shadow in our own times. We ask this prayer through Christ our Lord. Amen.
Good morning, I'm Dr. Michael Carter, a historian at English Heritage, which cares for Byland Abbey and 400 other monuments across the country. Byland Abbey, at the end of the 12th century, was described as one of the shining lights of religion in the north. Likewise, Rievaulx Abbey was lauded in such terms, and it's only a short distance from Byland. And today it's remembered by some scholars and by people in the wider public because of these 12 remarkable ghost stories which were written by a monk of Byland in around about 1400. The very first story involves a servant of Rievaulx Abbey who is carrying a pannier of beans. His horse falls and breaks a leg, and he encounters a terrifying rearing horse that walks by his side. The man is terrified out of his wits, but he invokes for protection the holy name of Jesus, a very important devotion at that time. And eventually, this apparition is conjured to take human form and requests the man's spiritual services. He asks him to secure prayers so that his soul can ultimately find peace, be released from its purgatorial pains, this the man does, and the spirit is released. And I think it gives a fascinating insight into the role which monasteries such as Bylan played in providing spiritual services for the dead so that they could attain peace in heaven.
So, what was the point of Bylan? Its beating heart was the desire of a group of Christians to respond as fully as possible to the call of St. Paul to pray in the Spirit at all times in every season. Their aim was to live like the Christ of the Gospels, to be free as he was free, to love generously as he loved, and to live a life of service as he served, and by this means to enter into the kingdom of God. The monks knew that as individuals they might stumble or fall or lose their footing, but as a community, accepting common rules and regulations, they bound themselves together to carry each other when some were fragile and others were strong. No Pater Noster or Credo or Gloria intoned to heaven was ever lost. And as they sought the salvation of their own souls by their work, prayer and faithfulness, they cast wide the net of prayer for the salvation of all souls across the face of God's creation. A monastery like Bylan was a medieval power station of prayer. But such a journey always starts with an individual call and an individual response. Let us listen to a story from Mark's Gospel.
One of the teachers of the law came and heard them debating. Noticing that Jesus had given them a good answer, he asked him, "Of all the commandments, which is the most important?" "The most important one," answered Jesus, "is this: Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. The second is this: Love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these." "Well said, teacher," the man replied. "You are right in saying that God is one, and there is no other but him. To love him with all your heart, with all your understanding, and with all your strength, and to love your neighbour as yourself, is more important than all burnt offerings and sacrifices." When Jesus saw that he had answered wisely, he said to him, "You are not far from the kingdom of God." And from then on, no one dared ask him any more questions.
Michael Carter went along to the British Library to look at the Bylan Abbey manuscripts. There he met Eleanor Jackson, the curator of the illuminated manuscripts.
So this is the first page, and you can see here at the top, we've got the ownership inscription of Byland Abbey, so Liber Sanctae Mariae de Bellalandia. It's quite typical of a monastic library book from this period. It's quite functional. It's written in a small, neat script. There's not very much decoration, although there is a rather lovely red decorated letter to begin the text. You can see that it's been really well used over its lifetime. There's been lots of monks who've studied this text, lots of little annotations and notes in the edges of the pages.
And we can see these little pin marks, they look like, going down the side of the manuscript, can't we, on various leaves?
Yeah, so those are the pricking marks which would have been used to rule the lines for writing on.
I think they provide fascinating insights into the beliefs of the Middle Ages, and more specifically monks themselves. For the most part, these ghosts have come back from purgatory because they need a spiritual service being performed on their behalf.
Well, I think one of the things that's really striking about the Byland Abbey ghost stories is this idea about how the living have a duty of spiritual care towards the dead. Mm. You know, most of the stories, they're not about evil dead spirits coming back to cause harm. They're actually about people who've died with sins that they haven't rectified, and so they're not able to get into heaven. So they come back and they want to get living people to help them put these sins right so they can get into heaven. And this was part of a much wider medieval culture of taking care of the souls, praying for the dead. And this was something that the monks of Byland were obviously engaged in, but it was also something that was especially important to medieval women's communities, because women were not allowed to join the priesthood. They were not able to perform spiritual care through performing priestly functions. So the main way in which they were able to provide spiritual care was by praying for the souls of the dead. So you have a lot of this kind of medieval death culture coming from nunneries as well.
What I've found is the incredible vibrancy of female monasticism, just how valued they were by their local communities. The number of wills I found in medieval Yorkshire of people requesting the spiritual services of nuns to pray for their dead family members.
And in fact, among the surviving ghost stories from medieval England, quite a few of them concern nuns.
I'm now standing where the monks' choir stalls were once located within the church. I can see the high altar to my east. And the monks gathered in their stalls 8 times a day to sing the services, the Opus Dei, the work of God that was at the heart of their daily life. And there's a very touching German ghost story written by a Cistercian monk called Caesarius of Heisterbach, and it involves a young nun at a German Cistercian monastery. Now, this is a reminder that women were an essential component of the Cistercian life. In fact, here in Yorkshire, where there were 8 male Cistercian abbeys, there were 12 Cistercian nunneries, and their prayers were esteemed by people in the locality. Now, as I said, this is an incredibly touching story, and it involves a young nun called Sister Gertrude who dies. A few days after her death, her spirit appears in the choir stalls, a bright apparition, round the hour of Vespers, one of the great services. And Her sister in the religious life, sees this apparition and is much troubled by it. It's also seen by the mother abbess, who provides instruction to the nun, the young nun to whom the apparition had appeared, and said, should the apparition appear again, say to it blessings, and if it replies of the Lord, you can know it has been sent from Christ and not from Satan. So the apparition appears again, and the nun asks the blessings and gets the appropriate reply. And the Sister Gertrude's spirit said, I've come back from purgatory because I used to whisper to you in the choir when I should have been singing the divine office. And I've come back as a punishment and also as a warning to you. It's a warning to you to give up girlish things and to embrace your life as a religious. Gertrude has to do this on 3 occasions before she is released from her purgatorial pains. Now, I think it's a very touching story. It's a reminder of the mortality in the Middle Ages, but of the bonds that endured in the cloister beyond death, that it is your spiritual responsibility to pay for your brothers and sisters in religious life, indeed all Christian souls. But it's also a reminder of just how hard life as a monk or nun was, that even to us a very minor transgression of whispering to your friend, somebody the same age as you, can earn you a place in purgatory where torment will be inflicted on your soul until it has been purged of sin and you can find peace in heaven. Well, we've now moved out of the church and are standing in the ruins of Byland's library. And I think you have to abandon ideas of a modern library. Effectively, what we're standing in is a small room where the 300 or 400 books that compose the library of Byland Abbey would have been stored. And one of these manuscripts contains a number of texts. And in around about 1400, one of the monks at Byland, we don't know who it was, found some leaves of blank vellum, and monks could never resist filling these leaves with jottings and musings of various sorts. And he recorded 12 local ghost stories. And they're known to us because of M.R. James, or Montagu Rhodes James, who was one of the great medievalists of his day. And he published a transcription of the ghost stories just over 100 years ago. And I'm here standing in the library with fellow enthusiast for monasteries and the Gothic. It's Professor Dale Townsend.
Thank you, Michael. The haunted monastery becomes a very important trope in Gothic fiction of the 18th and 19th centuries. But to move forward in time and cultural history to M.R. James, it's very clear that James's short stories continue this interest in sacrilege narratives and the dreadful consequences that befall those who misappropriate a once consecrated object. His stories teem with objects that have been dislocated from their original religious contexts and as a result wreak havoc in the present upon those who dare to tamper with them. I'm interested in the haunting of Britain's monasteries in a very different sense from the ways in which we've been thinking about haunting and ghosts so far. And I think the tale or the story of the haunting of Britain's monasteries goes back to the dissolution of the monasteries in the 1530s by Henry VIII and Thomas Cromwell. Now, of course, literal ruination of these once majestic buildings was not the only ways in which they were destroyed, but they were also repurposed. So, for example, you will have the beginning of the 18th century, the high church antiquary Brown Willis talking about the despoilation of Netley Abbey in Hampshire and how one William Taylor, who was a carpenter, tried to break down parts of the building in converting it into his own domestic habitation. He is visited by the ghost of a monk who warns him against further acts of despoilation. But what seems to happen is that he ignores this ghostly warning. And a few days later, he is continuing to despoil this abbey, and he is crushed by a bit of masonry that falls from one of the high windows and killed.
Well, we're now standing in the cloister of Byland Abbey in one of the walkways, and in front of me is the chapter house where the monks gathered every day to hear a reading of the rule of St. Benedict, which guided their daily life. I'm going to talk about one of the ghost stories that is actually set here within Byland Abbey. And it doesn't involve a soul searching the prayers of the monks, seeking spiritual salvation. It involves a revenant. His name in life was James Tankerley, and he was a local parish priest. And he's been buried before the entrance to the chapter house at Byland. And now that's one of the very best places in a monastery to be buried of all. And he rises, the story says, at night from his grave and wanders over the moors to nearby Cold Kirby, where he'd been parish priest, where he gouges out the eye of his former concubine. The story continues that the monks, you won't be surprised to hear, are somewhat perturbed by these happenings. The community resolve to exhume the body of Tankerley and to throw it in a nearby lake. Now, this is because these revenants, which have their origins in the dark imaginings of the forests and meres of pre-Christian Northern Europe, cannot be saved by pious prayer. They're evil to their rotting core. And the body is placed on a cart and taken to a nearby lake, the Gormire, which the abbey owns. And we're told that the oxen dragging it almost balked in fear. But the author of the ghost stories adds a note at the end and said, well, what if indeed Tankerley's soul could have been saved? What have my brethren here done if he could indeed one day have been counted amongst the blessed? And there's a real reminder there that it's the business of monks to be saving souls, not damning them to perdition.
I am Abbess Anna Brennan of Stanbrook Abbey. I'm a Benedictine nun. I live in a new-built, eco-friendly monastery on the top of a hill in North Yorkshire. On the plain below my monastery lie the ruins of an ancient monastery, Byland Abbey. Monks lived there for almost 400 years, leaving only in 1538 at the dissolution of the monasteries by Henry VIII. The now deserted monastery was plundered, leaving the ruins we see today. 16th century monks, 21st century nuns, separated in time by almost 500 years, but united in a common purpose. We both seek God. This is our path to holiness, to saintliness. It's what our founder, St. Benedict, asked of us in his rule, written in the 6th century. It's a simple call with only one purpose, life with God. But this call is not only for monks and nuns, despite their life being quite different from that of other people. It's the call of all who believe in Christ. St. Paul used to address his letters to the saints in the early churches he founded round the Mediterranean. Saints, for him, were not canonized, those who had already died and gone gloriously to heaven. They were people like you and me, striving to live good lives here and now in the ordinary circumstances of life. On Friday, we celebrated one of the most encouraging, hope-filled feasts in the Christian calendar, All Saints. During the rest of the year, we celebrate individual canonized saints or groups of them. But last Friday's feast reminds us of what St. Paul knew early on, that there is, in fact, much more holiness around than we probably imagine, that holiness and goodness are not reserved for special types of people. Extraordinary feats of sanctity, which often mark canonized saints, are not necessary. Ordinary believers who live according to their own calling, who strive to do what is right and good, who are often not remembered or identified in this world, but known and loved individually and personally by God. This is holiness, sainthood. That's why the Feast of All Saints is so joyful. We are either already saints, or we're on the way to being so, believe it or not. You might think that the empty, plundered ruins of Byland Abbey have no meaning and are of little value. But that's not the case at all. There is a haunting mystery and beauty about Byland. It resonates with the life of the monks who lived there, who searched for God and found holiness by being faithful to their search, despite their human weaknesses. The West Front is, for me, very powerful. In its time, it formed an imposing entrance, marked by a delicately crafted rose window above the large doors of the Abbey Church. Most of the stonework has fallen away, to leave what I see as a finger pointing heavenwards, raising our minds, hearts and souls to what is beyond, to our destiny in God. In Latin, we speak of Digitus Dei, the finger of God calling us upward, beyond the ordinary and visible, to himself. The finger is not real. It's there only in my imagination. But it is symbolic. And symbols are very powerful. They work within us, leading us to ever deeper truth. It's said that ghosts haunt the ruins and villages around Byland. Are we to be afraid of them, spooked by them? I don't think so. Read the stories carefully and you see a common theme. The ghosts are lost souls searching pitifully to find rest in God. All they ask of those to whom they show themselves is that they pray and arrange masses for them, to free them from the sins they have committed and which still bind them to this world, that prevent them from seeing God and going to their eternal rest. On Saturday, the day after the Feast of All Saints, we commemorate All Souls. It's a day of great humanity and insight. On one level, we naturally remember loved ones who have died. But we also know that to live with God, we need to be freed from anything that hinders our vision of him. We can't do this alone. and the thoughts and prayers of the living help. Some day, we ourselves may need the same help.
So let us bring our prayers before the Lord. We give thanks to the Lord for the saints who have gone before us, marked with the sign of faith. They heard the call and responded with lives filled with hope and love. May their example inspire us in our lives. Lord, in your mercy,
hear our prayer.
We pray for the souls of those who died in this last year. We pray especially for those who might have died suddenly or unexpectedly, and for those to whom we didn't manage to say farewell. Lord, in your mercy,
hear our prayer.
For a world in turmoil, where we might feel helpless or paralyzed, let us recognize our role as a praying community this morning. For these few moments, we, like the monks of Byland, are assembled as a power station of prayer. So let us pray, through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, for peace in our world. Lord, in your mercy,
hear our prayer.
Let us pray for the people of the United States, that as they vote, they may be open-hearted in seeking to do what is right. And after the election, may they strive for reconciliation and the common good. Lord, in your mercy,
hear our prayer.
So let us pray in the words of Jesus as we say, Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. Let us pray. Lord, give us the insight to know your most holy will and the grace to perfectly fulfill it. Amen.
This week's Sunday Worship was presented by Father Dermot Preston from the ruins of Byland Abbey in Yorkshire. The producer was Carmel Lonergan, and it was a BBC Audio North production for Radio 4. Now here's James Naughtie with the last in his series of essays exploring America's search for meaning.
A mere year ago, so long it seems now, before Iowa and New Hampshire and the first campaigning, before the Trump bulldozer was in gear, when Joe Biden was still a vigorous candidate president dreaming of a second term, I drove into the woods of Northern Virginia on a fine fall day to meet a general. Michael Hayden, now in his 80th year, served in the U.S. Air Force for decades, then reached the top of the National Security Agency and became, eventually, director of the CIA, bridging the Bush and Obama presidencies. There can't be many secrets he didn't once know, but no point in asking about them. Instead, over tea, we spoke about American democracy, and without a hint of theatricality, he confessed his fear. "I don't know that we'll come through this," he told me. "Right now, I think it's about 50-50. A stroke had slowed him down and his voice was quiet, but his eyes gleamed when he spelt out his alarm. He couldn't be sure that the democratic system he had served all his life would survive in recognizable form. A lifelong Republican, he wondered if politics was broken. He had seen a president look on immobile from the White House while a mob stormed the Capitol to try to hijack the peaceful transfer of power after an election in 2020, and believed that someday others like them would try again, and who knows, might win. 50-50, on the edge. For me, that conversation hovers over these closing days of the 24 campaign that dissolve into one question, in every sense, a question of survival. So much noise. High-tech campaigns, the torrent of soundbites, the dissection of every community by gender, class, and personal taste so that it can be allocated by an algorithm precisely what a campaign thinks it wants rather than what it needs. All this has depersonalized politics while pretending to do the opposite. Was it once simpler? I was a rookie reporter 13 presidential elections ago when I found a way into my first convention, Jimmy Carter's in 1976. The Georgia governor came north to New York to claim the Democratic nomination over the bloodied body of the party machine. He had done it with a campaign in which veterans joked about the candidate who campaigned through the primaries as an innocent abroad, like some prairie preacher flying into town carrying his own suitcase. Who'd ever heard of such a thing? Well, he won. And when he claimed his prize in Madison Square Garden, he opened his acceptance speech with the line that had seemed naive when he was introducing himself to voters in diners and school halls across the country, but was now a boast. "My name's Jimmy Carter, and I'm running for president." After the era of Watergate sleaze and the lingering pain of the Vietnam divisions, his party wanted straightforwardness again. And it turned out, so did the country. Different in the White House. When he spoke with that same candor about the energy crisis brought on by soaring oil prices and with early warnings of a climate crisis in his head, he called the challenge the moral equivalent of war. But Americans decided it was actually a war on their gas-guzzling cars, and by the time the Iran hostage crisis clouded his last year in office, they had fallen hopelessly out of love with Jimmy Carter. But in life after the presidency, he's the only occupant of the Oval Office to have reached 100, which he did last month. He burnished the powerful simplicity of his early days, not just with a presidential library, but a foundation dedicated to the promotion and protection of democracy around the world. Constitution writing, election monitoring, hands-on civics masterclasses, much of it done by himself, almost to the end. He would call it service. But as the centenarian in Plains, Georgia, looks out on his own country now, he will see a democracy under strain, a Supreme Court that tilted sharply rightwards during the Trump years, state governments agitating to go their own separate ways, for example on super-tight abortion restrictions and bans. A Congress paralysed by ideological polarisation, battles in courts across the country, even on fundamental voting rights and election law, the bedrock. And behind, a phalanx of the super-rich, exploiting looser controls on money and politics, not only to place their bets, but to maximise their influence. They will still be there after Tuesday. If Donald Trump wins, he promises radicalism, saying he wants to clean out the deep state, appointing by executive order thousands, thousands of partisan loyalists in place of civil servants, government recast in his mould. The forced deportation of millions of immigrants. Kevin Roberts of the right-wing think tank The Heritage Foundation, whose Project 2025 is the ideological pulse underneath, described it like this in the summer. We are in the process of the second American Revolution, which will remain bloodless if the left allows it to be. And if Kamala Harris wins to become the first woman president, she'll face the stern challenges she has set herself, for example, to make visible progress on an immigration system that can be humane and robust, and in persuading Americans that the economy is stronger. She believes in a more liberal America, but she knows that millions of citizens, not all of them fully-fledged Trumpers, do not. And as for the world outside, the contrast between the candidates' different plans for the country's dealings with its allies and adversaries is the widest we have known since before the Second World War. Well, this is not the time nor the place for predictions. Not now. Instead, a warning. Division over the results will be raw and bitter. Think of 2020. And protracted disputes are bound to start in the states where it's close. A system will be on trial. The brink. Remember the hanging chads, those fragments of paper ballots in Florida in 2000 that were argued about for weeks, plane loads of lawyers shuttling to and from Washington to fight over the vote, Democrats forced to accept only in mid-December that the courts would not force a statewide recount. Al Gore conceded Florida, and therefore the election, and George W. Bush became president by 537 votes in a country then of more than 280 million people. In the end, so close and so divided. There's an especially poignant scene towards the end of Edwin O'Connor's 1950s novel, The Last Hurrah, a kind of hymn to Boston politics. The veteran mayor, who's a cunning old fox, thinks his last election is in the bag. The precinct captains and the tally men have done their work, and he's watching the totals chalked up on the blackboards. Everyone is preparing for a party. Then he spies, before anyone else, a couple of ominous numbers lurking in the returns, telling a story of votes gone astray. In a back room, he works the phones and quickly learns the truth. He has lost. It's over. The book is a loving portrait of rough big city politics and an elegy. The mayor is vanquished by a new breed of candidate, television savvy and smooth and funded by different kinds of people. It's always worth revisiting The Last Hurrah, not just for the characters and their frolics, but to revel in that feeling for a political world in transition. America today. But this time, the fundamentals of its system are in dispute daily. Votes and voting rights are the stuff of combat in courtrooms, state legislatures, and sometimes in the streets. 50-50. On the edge. At election time, the country always looks majestic in its fall foliage. All of New England seems ablaze. Follow the line of the Appalachians south, and the colours are like a riot on an artist's easel. Whole mountainsides washed in gold and crimson. River valleys so rich in scarlet and orange that it feels as if you're travelling through a fiery furnace that has turned mysteriously peaceful and cool. A calming image as the hours tick down to Tuesday, and one by one, The leaves begin to fall. I'm taken back to those Virginian woods. I wonder what the old general is thinking right now.
Nochte on America was presented by James Nochte. The producer was Sheila Cook and the editor Richard Fenton Smith. Now on Radio 4, Tweet of the Day, produced by Andrew Dawes at BBC Audio Bristol. The new graduate and wildlife sound recordist Arjun Dutta recalls bee eaters in Bulgaria.
In Britain, brightly coloured birds are less easy to encounter compared to other areas of the world. Blue tits could be a contender if they weren't so common, or possibly a kingfisher could add some proper bling to the UK's avian life. Maybe that is why the European bee eater, a rare summer visitor to our shore, is so popular. Recent breeding attempts in the UK have shown that few species bring as much excitement and admiration as bee eaters. Bee eaters resemble flying rainbows with their kaleidoscopically coloured plumage, ranging from the richest chestnut through to yellow and a blue-green. They are one of those birds that can unite any audience with the natural world, even if, in our pastoral countryside, they seem a little out of place. A year ago, I was in Bulgaria doing university research. Overhead, while I worked, groups of bee eaters kept me company throughout the day, their endless chattering and bickering adding to their charm. Back home each summer,